Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 9:03 p.m. on Tuesday, February 17, 2015. Present today, we have Representative, Co-Chair Representative Newman, Vice Chair Representative Sadler, Representative Edgemond, Representative Gaddis, Representative Munoz, Representative Pruitt, Representative Kawasaki, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Thompson. A couple of members will be showing up in the next 10 minutes. They had other meetings that they were in.
Or have to be in,
like yourself. Before we start, please turn off your cell phones. They do interfere with recording equipment. Today's schedule, we're going to hear a presentation by Analytica and the impacts of oil and gas production tax credits at low prices. Mr. Mayor, Mr. Sofos, if you'd come forward, place yourselves on the record. We'll begin your presentation. A.M. Did I say P.M.? It's A.M., by the way.
Seems late.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. For the record, Janik Mayer, partner at Analytica. It's a great pleasure to be here. My fourth consecutive year coming in, sitting at this table and a number of others in the building after 2 years of giving advice and testimony on oil and gas production taxes, and then last year with my colleague Nikos talking about Alaska LNG and all of the work done last year to move that project forward, and now continuing that work both to talk about AKLNG, but here to talk today back on the topic of the tax system and in particular recent numbers on tax credits and what those look like in the current low oil price environment. We have prepared two papers that have also been distributed. One is a general background looking at the oil market and what are the fundamentals going on that are driving the low oil prices that we see at the moment to get a better understanding of that. And the other looks more specifically at this question of tax credits in this current environment and what those look like and what the reasons for some of what we're seeing are. So the presentation we wanted to give today is an overview of both of those two things at the high level. And to kick it off, I will hand over to my colleague Nikos to talk about the macro level oil price picture.
For the record, Nikos Tsafos, partner at Analytica. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for inviting us to be back here to speak to this committee. My own background is I spent the last 10 years or so as an oil and gas consultant. Most of my time spent in natural gas, advising companies who are looking to either buy gas, sell gas, or trying to make sense of the market. But I've also spent a big part of my time studying the global energy system, including oil markets, and so I'm going to put that hat on for today's presentation. So let's kick it off.
If I might stop for just a second, they've got quite a presentation, and we're going to hold questions till the end of the presentation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Nick.
For the record, Nikos Tsafos again. What I wanted to start us off with is price of oil, I'm sure you know, has gone from about 115 last summer to about 55, 60. And what I wanted to do is spend about three slides trying to walk us through why did this happen. Okay, so I don't necessarily want to tell you where the price is going to be this year or next year. I want to put you in the shoes of someone who works at either an oil company, a bank, a consulting firm, who's looking at this and trying to say, what on earth is going on here? So I want to walk you through a little bit their thinking, what kind of data points they're looking at to try to make sense of this world. Okay?
We've been joined by Representative Kawasaki.
I think. Nikos Tsafos again, for the record. So let's begin with slide two. We have three charts that kind of try to summarize most of the things that you really need to know about what's happened in the oil market. So let's begin from the chart on the left-hand side. And what this shows you is two numbers. One is, in the red line, the growth in U.S. production relative to January 2010. And this is a nice way of saying the U.S. is producing a lot more oil. Okay? So basically, relative to January 2010, the U.S. has added about 4.5 to 5 million barrels a day of production. For reference, world market, about 90. Right? So 5 is a big number. Now, in the normal scheme of things, when someone adds so much production to the market, prices come down. They didn't. The reason they didn't is because as the U.S. was adding, something else was happening elsewhere in the world to take supply off the market. I'm not talking about deliberate action by OPEC. I'm talking about disruptions to supply, physical disruptions to supply. So, for instance, you can see in early 2011, that green line, which shows the unplanned outages, which is a nice way of saying shut-ins, disruptions, you can see that number really shooting up. And that's the beginning of the civil war in Libya. So Libyan production gets disrupted, then Libyan production comes back, then the Syrian civil war starts. So Syrian oil gets taken off the market. And then once that sort of stabilizes, then the U.S. and its allies tighten sanctions on Iran. So Iranian production comes off the market. And you can basically see this is, you can't make that stuff up. It's incredible. Those two lines, with the exception of 2011, are almost moving in tandem. So whatever the U.S. is adding, somewhere else is taking off the market. So as a result, if you go to the second chart, the middle chart, which shows you the world liquids production, on the green is the actual production, on the red is just the yearly average, you can see is that you had a little bit of growth in, you know, 2012, and then very little growth in, you know, 12 to 13. So effectively what this means is U.S. was growing 5 million barrels a day. The world wasn't seeing the benefit of that. Then we come up to about the middle of this year, and I'm taking you back now to the left chart, the green line, outages. And you can see outages really coming down. Okay, that's the last part of the left chart. And for the most part, this was Libyan production. So Libyan production, even though there's still effectively a civil war going on, came back on the market. So suddenly, the U.S., you can see from about the middle of 13, but definitely in the last part of the of 14, effectively what had been two offsetting forces were now two forces that joined together. U.S. was growing, and outages were coming back, so there were less shut-in production. So then we go to the middle chart, and what you see effectively is that red line, the yearly average for 2015, really shooting up. Right. So from 2012 to 2013, the market added only about 400,000 barrels a day. From 13 to 14, it added 1.6 million. Right. Huge amount of growth. So remember that 1.6 million added production. Hold, commit that number to memory for 3 minutes. Let's talk about demand, and then we can see how those two things come together.
We've been joined by Representative Guerra. Go ahead.
Nikosafos again for the record. So on the right, what we've tried to depict in a succinct way are what we would call demand expectations. So there are a number of analysts, observers, who put out their forecasts for what they think is going to happen in the world market. The International Energy Agency, which is basically the energy part of the OECD, formed after the first oil shock, they put out a monthly report on oil markets that is publicly available. The Energy Information Administration at the U.S. Department of Energy does the same thing. OPEC does this, and then a number of banks and consultancies put out these reports. We picked the International Energy Agency one, not because it really fits our story well, although it does, but because it's also the most widely read report. So in terms of representing a more or less consensus or a broad view of what's happening in the markets, this is the report to look at. And so what you can see is the green line shows their forecast for the growth in oil demand and how it's changed over time. So this is a slightly sort of confusing graph, so let me walk you through it. So in January 2014, the IEA said that the oil market was going to grow by 1.4%. In February 2014, they said the same thing. In March, they said, it's actually going to go 1.5%. Then in April, they brought it back down to 1.4%. And then in May and June, they raised it again. They said, actually, it's going to go back to 1.5%. And then see what happens when you hit the summer. Suddenly, every month, they're like, 1.4, 1.5, 1.4, 1.5. Suddenly, everything changes. So within a six-month period, you go from an expectation of about a 1.5% growth to about 0.7% growth. Okay? The same thing happens for their expectation for 2015. So when the forecasting for 15 started, which was the middle of 14, they said, look, 15 is still going to be a good year. We're going to grow by 1.5%. Within 6 months, that became 1%. Now, there are a number of reasons for that. Most of them had to do with the global economy. Some of them had to do with sort of the initial numbers for 2014 coming in and people saying, hey, when you start looking at what's actually happening in 14, we're expecting too much in 14. We need to correct down. So a number of things happened. But effectively, if you put those two things together, remember, this is a 90 million barrel a day market, right? 90 million barrel a day. So when you take off 1 percentage point of growth, you're taking off 900,000 barrels of growth. And when you take off 0.5 percentage point of growth in 2015, you're taking off another 450,000 barrels of growth. So remember these numbers. So we said before, supply, which was kind of flat, suddenly grew by 1.6 million barrels. And demand basically got revised down by 1.4 million barrels a day of demand expectation for the next sort of year and a half or 2 years. So it was those two things, when you bring them together, that really led to the crash in the price. Okay? So this is a really long way of saying it was supply and demand. But both of these things just happened to coincide at exactly the same time. Okay. So this explains why the price started to fall. The immediate question that comes up is, where's OPEC? What's OPEC doing? Why aren't they stepping in to stabilize prices? So let's go to the next slide and talk a little bit about OPEC.
Representative Guttenberg has joined us also.
For the record, Nikos Tsafos again. Now, OPEC basically met in November and said, yeah, what's happening is kind of crazy, but we're not really going to do anything. And that was a moment at which any conception of an OPEC-enforced floor went away. So anyone who thought, hey, this price drop is going to stop because of OPEC, they realized, yeah, that's not going to happen. So you started thinking differently about the oil market. Now, what I wanted to do is, you know, maybe spend about 5 minutes in sort of OPEC 101 and OPEC history, because I think it's useful in placing today's decision in a slightly broader context. So you have two charts in front of you that try again to summarize sort of the history of OPEC in one slide. So obviously a little bit of a simplification, but in the grand scheme of things, we think it works. On the top side, on the top graph, what you see is the market share of OPEC, effectively a way of saying OPEC production divided by global production. Okay? It's a pretty straightforward number. On the bottom chart, what you see is the quotas that OPEC members have for themselves. So the chief way through which OPEC manages the market, it sets a quota for how much its members are going to produce. So if you see quotas going down, that's basically an agreement to cut. If you see quotas going up, that's basically an agreement to increase production. Now, the one thing you will notice on the chart in the bottom, lots of different colors. What those colors tell us is who actually agreed to those quotas. And you can see that the green, which is all of OPEC, having agreed to the quota is actually an exception, not the rule. A lot of times you have either Iraq being excluded. Sometimes you have Iraq and Kuwait when the two countries were in war in 1990. Sometimes you have exclusion of Iran and Iraq. Sometimes you have exclusions of other players. So, again, just because OPEC does something or says something doesn't mean that everyone in OPEC is in line. Okay.
Representative Wilson's joined us.
Questions, sir?
We were going to hold questions until the end.
Just to... Just
clarification. Go ahead.
Silly. Mr. Ex-Iraq, Kuwait, excluding? What's the X stand for? I'm the legend at the bottom of the second chart.
Except Iraq and...
Except, yes.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Go ahead.
Thanks.
For the record, Nikos Tsafos. So what we've tried then to identify is three broad behaviors, and that's what is represented by the shaded areas in both charts. Now, OPEC was formed in 1960. It didn't institute quotas until 1982, which is why the chart in the bottom covers a shorter period of time than the chart on the top. Right? OPEC basically until 1982 had other ways of trying to manage the market. Setting formal quotas for its members was not one of them. Okay? So if we took that back to 1960, it would just have been empty, so we cut it out. Now, there was one period of time, starting roughly 1970, that OPEC really tried to set prices. And what we mean by set prices is it had a target of keeping the price, which you could say would be artificially high. And the way to do that was basically, especially since the Arab oil embargo in 73, the chief way of doing that was to cut its own production. So if you want to keep production high, you have to ration supply. If you're the only one who's trying to keep prices high, you're the one who's rationing supply. And so in the process, what happened is they kept prices high, but in doing so, they really invited a ton of other production to come into the market, including Alaska. Alaska was made possible by OPEC's efforts to keep prices artificially high. And so what happened is once you go from a market share of about 50, 55% to a market share of 30, you start really getting upset. And particularly what happened was a lot of that adjustment, especially in the 80s, was done by Saudi Arabia. They were the only ones cutting. So they got to the point where they basically were the only ones trying to hold this market together and try to keep these prices up, and they just kept cutting and cutting and cutting. And at some point in about 1986, they said, you know what, enough is enough. We're just not going to do this anymore. We're not going to be, you know, the idiots in the room that keep cutting and everyone else just keeps producing and making money on our backs. So they changed their policy and just started producing more. And that basically crashed the price. The price crash of 86 came as a result of that change. So remember that period. And then if you go forward from basically 86 onwards to the late 1990s, OPEC followed the market. The way to think about this is oil, as you all know, is a long-term business. It takes a while to find oil, to come up with a plan to develop it, to actually develop it. And so inevitably, a long-term business leads to cycles because the price goes up, the incentive to explore is there, but it takes you 5, 7, 10 years to respond with production once the price goes up. So the chief role for OPEC was, because it had what we call spare capacity, had the ability to produce more than it was producing, it was able to step in and convert a long-term cyclical business into a short-term, less cyclical business. The reason OPEC had so much spare capacity was because a lot of this was built, you know, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, before the nationalization of the oil industries in OPEC countries. And because of the decline in sort of the 80s, they were producing less and less, so they had the capacity for more, they were just producing less and less. And so you can see the chart on the top, the follow market period, where the market share of OPEC sort of regains. And you can see the same thing happening in the quotas. You can start from, you know, where it switches from price setting to follow market. You can see that basically they just kind of kept increasing quotas until they reach a sort of a stabilization point, effectively trying to just produce more in order to keep the market stable. Then comes the next phase in OPEC behavior, which is called stabilization. So the idea was that this was an effort not necessarily to set the price, but to manage more actively the market. What happened there is you can see in the beginning, I'm looking at the bottom chart, you can see the note right before April 98, that green line that really shoots up. So basically that was a meeting where OPEC decided to increase production just as the Asian financial crisis was kicking in. And so that basically led to the next price crash in 98 as OPEC tried to increase production. Now, quickly they realized their mistake, so they started cutting back. And then they said, oh, you know, we cut back too much. So then it shoots up. I'm looking at this sort of April 98 to April 2002 period. So then they say, oh, we cut too much, so let's increase production. They say, oh, we increased production too much, so we can keep cutting again. So basically this shows you that this was an era where they were just trial and error, never quite figured it out. So by the time you exit that point, they said, you know what, forget it. Let's just stop changing quotas every month, trying to micromanage this market. We're not doing a good job anyway. And that's why you see that flattening out for about a year. They said, let's just let the market play out, see what happens, rather than trying to micromanage. And effectively, from 2002 all the way to the recent financial crisis, OPEC kept increasing supply and stabilizing, then increasing supply again, and basically just trying to follow the market. You can see that both in the quotas and in the production chart above. And then comes the financial crisis in 2008, Lehman Brothers in September. The price of oil goes from 147 in the summer to about 40-something in December. And you can see that OPEC basically has successive cuts. Now I'm looking at the shaded area on the bottom chart called stabilization, the last section called stabilization. And you can see the blue line kind of keeps dropping, and then there's a big drop in the yellow line going to 25 mil. So that's basically OPEC successively cutting in order to stabilize pricing. And then after that period of time, which did stabilize prices, they went up to a 30 million barrel a day quota and haven't really done anything since then. So this is a long way of saying OPEC doesn't control oil prices. The one time they did try to control, they were only able to do that by taking a huge hit in their market share. They've tried a couple of times to step in and stabilize the market with a short-term disruption. One time in the late 80s, they failed. The second time after 2008, they succeeded. But for big parts of their history, OPEC has been a follower of the market, mostly adding liquidity when liquidity is needed. So in the mindset of OPEC, they're thinking, hey, we're sort of in a period like the mid-70s, late 70s, 80s, where there's a ton of new oil coming into the market. If we try to keep price artificially high, then the crazy guys in Texas and North Dakota are just going to keep producing. So, and our market share will keep going down. Let's not do that. Instead, let's try to let prices fall, figure out what the new price is, and have some folks elsewhere go bankrupt rather than have us take the hit. So that is the broad outlines of the logic. Now, there's one thing that complicates that logic, and that is how oil is produced in the United States. So I want to take you now to slide 4 to just wrap up this discussion on oil pricing. As we said before when we started the discussion, the growth in U.S. oil production has been the fundamental shift in the oil market, huge amount of production. And that in itself has put downward pressure on pricing. But it's done a second thing, which is it's made the job of the oil price forecaster harder. Now, the job of the oil price forecaster is always tough. It's even worse now. And let me walk you through why. In the good old days, before U.S. tight oil, the forecasting of oil pricing ultimately boiled down to two exercises. You were trying to figure out what is the marginal barrel, what is the most expensive barrel. And for the last sort of 5 or 6 years, that most expensive barrel was coming from two sources, either Canadian oil sands or deep water production. Okay, that was the most expensive barrel. So you said, look, those projects need $70, $80, $90. So that's basically a floor. If prices go below that, they're not going to take investment. They're not going to invest. So that's going to cut back supply, and it's going to keep price at those points. So that was the basic logic. And that exercise, I can tell you because I've been through that exercise, is a relatively simple exercise. You look at the Canadian oil sands. There's maybe, you know, 20, 30 projects out there that you can have someone go model the economics of. And the deep water areas, again, cluster around 3 or 4 areas, and you can go identify, you know, a few dozen projects and model them. So coming up with that marginal barrel where it really mattered was an exercise that took, you know, a few weeks, set of identifiable projects that you could also monitor, right? It's very easy to know whether a mega project in Canada has been sanctioned or not. So it's very easy to know whether or not these projects are moving forward or not. So that was exercise number one. Exercise number two was try to figure out what is called the break-even price of countries. So this was the way of saying, what does Saudi Arabia, what does Iran, what does Venezuela need to either balance their budget or to balance their trade accounts? The rationale for that, which, as my previous slide made clear, was incorrect. But the rationale, the motivation was to say, hey, if Saudi needs 80 to balance his budget, if prices go below 80, Saudi is hurt, Saudi will step in to stop it. Right? So that was the logic, right? And this was basically what oil price forecasting was for a significant period of time. Relatively straightforward, because it's not a very difficult exercise to come up with the break-even price for Saudi Arabia's budget. You look at expenses, you look at production, you multiply the price, you come up with the number at which those two things equal. Then comes in the U.S. and really complicates everything. And it complicates everything in three ways. And those are the words listed up there, and there's some more words around that logic in our paper. Scalable, diffuse, variable. So scalable is really, you know, if you look at the Eagle Ford, basically from 2010, even 2011, out of nowhere came an area that went from almost zero to 1.5 million barrels a day. Right? This doesn't happen. It's happened actually outside of the U.S. only twice in the history of the oil market, in Libya and in the North Sea in the U.K., where someone went from zero to over 1 million barrels a day in 2 or 3 years. It also happened in Alaska, by the way. So it's rare. It just doesn't happen. The thing is, it's not just the Eagle Ford. It's actually three different areas where this has happened, the Permian in Texas and Bakken, mostly North Dakota, where it didn't quite start from zero because there was some existing production, but the growth was of the magnitude of 1 million barrels a day in effectively 2 or 3 years. So this matters because, you know, in conventional oil, adding 1.5 million barrels a year takes a much longer period of time. It also shows you how quickly the U.S. producing system can respond to high prices, right? So this is basically saying prices go up, we redeploy capital, we redeploy resources, rigs and people, and we just start drilling like crazy, and you get a ton of production out. This is, in a way, remember I said before, the chief benefit of OPEC for the oil market was to turn a long-term business into a short-term business. Well, this is a short-term business because your decision to drill is made today and the drilling can happen in a month and most of the production can come over the next 6 months to 9 months. So this is really a short-term business and you just keep drilling as long as you like the price. So scalable is one. Diffuse is the other one. And this, in our view, is probably the thing that makes forecasting the most difficult. If you think about Alaska, you know, three producers produce the overwhelming majority of oil in Alaska. And then you have a handful of smaller companies that are either producing small quantities or exploring. So when you try to figure out what's going to happen in Alaska, you're basically trying to put yourself in the shoes of 6 or 7 companies trying to figure out what they're going to do. Because that tells you more or less what's going to happen to the state. You know, are they going to cut back production? Are they going to increase or decrease expenditures? You know, those are very basic questions that you ask. Now you go to Texas. And in Texas, 2/3 of the oil production, not 90%, not 95%, 2/3 of the oil production is produced by 32 companies. Okay. So to get to 70, 80, 90%, you have to keep going down the list of 50, 60, 70 companies. And this is one state. You have North Dakota, different area. Other plays not on this chart, different competitive landscapes. And what makes it very different is, you know, if you try to figure out what BP, ConocoPhillips, and Exxon are going to do, you have sort of a basic, you know, framework for thinking about these companies. Now, you go to the lower 48, you have 32 companies, you know, some of them have debt they need to pay back. They don't care about whether they're making 15% rate of return. What they're caring about is not going bankrupt. You have companies that need to hold on to their acreage and will drill regardless. You have companies that may have hedged 50%, 67% of their output for the next year and a half. So they're still getting $100 oil. So what really makes it difficult is that this production profile is the result of so many different players with so many different incentives, financial capabilities, and ambitions, constraints, that really making sense of the system is much, much harder. And it's not just harder for the analysts, it's also harder for a country like Saudi Arabia. You know, what is the break-even price? Well, that's now a much harder exercise, and it's an exercise that if you do in March, you may have to redo again in May, and you may have to redo in June, right? Because these things change very quickly. The last thing that makes this very hard is variability. And this is one of the things that I would say is probably the least understood about the U.S. system, which is that no two wells are alike. Okay, that's pretty straightforward. But one well can be massively more productive than another well. We're talking about a factor of, say, 30. So you may have two wells next to each other. One of them breaks even at $20. The other one can break even at $130. Not because one company's smart, the other's stupid, but because of geology. So because of this huge difference in variability, you can cut a lot of investment, you can cut a lot of activity without doing anything to production. This is exactly what happened with gas. So after Lehman Brothers, the price of gas collapsed in the lower 48. It went from about, you know, $12, $13 down to, you know, $3, $4. The rig count, which is a proxy for how much drilling there is, was cut in half because people just didn't have money to drill. Production didn't go anywhere. It stayed flat. So you cut half of the activity without impacting production at all. Why? Because there's huge variability. Because you can cut 30 bad wells, and those are the same as cutting one good well. So the reason this matters is because, yes, prices are coming down, and you say producers are feeling the pinch. They don't have money. They don't have as much money to fund their capital expenditures. That's true. But they can still cut back quite a bit before production really gets hit. So one of the things that I always take when I look at the system is, a few years ago on natural gas, there was a period where prices start coming down. And, you know, I'm a consultant that studies the space, so I comment on this, I see what other people say. And the general view was, people said, you know what, the break-even price in U.S. gas is around $4. Right? So once prices go below 4, people will feel the pinch. So it got to 4, then got to 350, and said, people said, you know what, I think 350 is the break-even price. And then you got to 3, and people said, you know what, 3, that's the break-even price. And then you got to 250, and then you got to 2, and then you went below 2. So you started off with, you know, 4 is the break-even price. You got to about 150, 180 before there was a true break-even price and people really started cutting. So the point is that what we've seen in the gas market, where these dynamics are similar in the lower 48, is because of this being so diffuse, because there's so many different players involved with so many different financial objectives and constraints, really making sense of what the price is very difficult. So as my colleague Janet likes to put it, what we have now is a process of price discovery. Saudi Arabia is trying to figure out what the break-even price of oil is, because no one really knows, because it's really hard to figure it out. And Saudi Arabia has two choices. Either it can dictate the price and say, I want the price to be 50, 60, 70, 80, and see how supply and demand react. Or it can say, I'm just going to step back, take some popcorn, eat some popcorn, see where all these things happen, and see where the price settles, and then we'll know. And once you know, then you can come in and sort of say, okay, I'm going to defend that price, I'm going to stabilize that price, I'm going to push it up, push it down. But you want to start off with, a basic understanding of where reality is. I didn't promise you a forecast of where prices are going, so I'm not going to try to do that. But what I wanted to give you a sense of, first of all, how do we get to the point where we are today? Why did prices really collapse? But secondly, why we are headed for a period of true uncertainty and volatility in the market, where a lot of the assumptions that people like me and my colleagues in the consulting and analytics business have used to make sense of this market are no longer applicable. So as we went through this presentation in the Senate Finance Committee, one senator jumped in and said, so, Nikos, what you're telling me is, in general, we don't know what's going to happen to oil prices. But what you're telling us is, now we really don't know. And I thought this was a really nice way of summarizing the presentation, which I realize is not particularly useful for someone whose budget depends on that crazy price. But that's sort of where we are. So that's what we wanted to talk about in terms of oil. Maybe we can pause here in case, or we can also just keep going to the tax credit conversation. Up to you, Mr. Chairman. But the first portion of the presentation is over.
Any questions on that first part? Representative Guttenberg?
So I have some bad news for you. You're not the first people at oil analysts to come to us and say, we really don't know in the end. We're just doing the best we can to analyze it, but we're often is not wrong.
All right. Well,
that's one question. Thank you. Just in general, has there been any paradigmatic shift in oil in energy usage in the nation, in the world? I mean, with the prices of oil the way they are, is there any structural change to return from natural gas or hydro or nuclear towards oil? Are we seeing any structural changes in the world energy market that would have implications for the future price of oil?
Representative Sattler, through the chair, for the record, Nikos Tsafos. If you look in the grand scheme of things, if you sort of really step back, there has been a general substitution away from oil towards other fuels. If you look at the United States, for example, oil made up a smaller percentage of energy use in America since basically right after World War II. The main reason for that, about 80% of that, was because of switching from oil to something else. There are still parts of the Northeast that use oil in residential and commercial use. There is still some oil used in the power sector, oil used by industry. All these things have shifted as much as they can. There's still a little bit more to go, but there's been a huge amount of shifting. There's also even shifting in the transportation system. Mostly in the U.S. towards biofuels, which, depending on how one defines oil, is sometimes included, sometimes not included, because a lot of times we're talking about liquids rather than oil. So there's definitely been that shift happening away from oil. You also have a broad improvement in what we call efficiency, and chiefly this is for the oil market, efficiency in car mileage. Right? And so if you go through the history of, you know, miles per gallon in the U.S., you see for a long period of time this number was going down, so cars were becoming less efficient. Then the first oil embargo, the oil embargo of 73 comes in, so there's a huge shift on that. And then it sort of jumps up for about 15 years, then it kind of stops. And over the last 10 years or 5 years, you've had the next sort of wave of increases. That's a structural thing that doesn't necessarily change, right? So, you know, if you buy a more fuel-efficient car, even if the price of gasoline goes down, your car remains fuel-efficient. But what you saw over the last sort of, I would say, since 2005, 6, you started to see some behavioral changes by, for example, American consumers. And what you saw really was vehicle ownership going down. That's partly because, you know, in urban areas, having a car is less useful. But it's also because people responded to the price signal. The price of gasoline was very expensive. In fact, there was a really interesting, for the U.S. market, a situation where the vehicle ownership went down, motorcycle ownership was up by almost a similar amount in absolute numbers. So you have some changes in behavior of how people are reacting. What is not clear is whether or not the drop in prices is going to reverse some of those things. So if people had said, oh, I really shouldn't get this car because it gets terrible mileage, then started looking at the price of the pup and said, ah, you know what, whatever. You know, you only live once. Let's go do it. So it's not clear how much of that really happens. Now, if you look at the U.S. and Europe is obviously much further ahead in terms of efficiency, partly because of very high taxation of gasoline. And so the reversal of those trends is harder because the price difference isn't quite as striking as it is in the U.S. Now, if you look at the rest of the world, part of the challenge is a lot of the rest of the world, the price that the consumer pays at the pump is a lot more determined by policy and regulation than it is by global markets. For example, the consumer in Saudi Arabia is not seeing much of a difference in the price of the pump, because the price of the pump has nothing to do with the price of crude oil in global markets. So there's a huge amount of consumption in the world that is basically the price is not changing for that consumption. So a drop in the price of oil wouldn't necessarily lead to a change in consumption and consumption behavior, because the consumer is not seeing the difference, right? If a government sets prices at a set rate, prices can go up or down in the global market. It doesn't really matter for the consumer. Now, to finalize this, I think what you've generally seen is in short periods of time, the amount of switching possible is rather limited, right? I mean, if you live in Anchorage and you get natural gas in your home, you know, you're not checking the price of oil and gas on a daily basis to try to figure out if you're going to heat your home with gas or oil, right? But, you know, big industrial users do that, right? So the amount of short-term switching is rather limited. And so you will see, as a result of these price differentials, a little bit of a demand pickup from consumers that really have the ability to switch back and forth. But if you forecast out, I think the real question is how sustained is this price drop? I mean, if you have a belief that this is a price drop that we're going to be at 50 for the next 5 years, you know, that decision is going to reverberate through consumer choices, types of cars you buy, whether you decide to, you know, live 5 miles away from the city center or 20 miles. Those kind of decisions could be. You can see those coming back into play and affecting consumption.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nikos, this can be a short answer. So you addressed the percentage of oil as compared to all of these other energy sources, but and I don't want to get into what affects price because we don't know. but what I'd like to know is, I mean, one of the factors of price is demand. So I know the percentage of oil as compared to other things has gone down, but in terms of absolute demand for oil, has that gone down also, or is that roughly stable?
Representative Gaffer, the chair. In the U.S., it's gone down primarily because of substitution of oil towards other things. So little of the demand growth is because people are consuming less energy. Mostly it's because people are consuming other things rather than oil. If I remember correctly, it was 80% of the absolute drop in demand was because of fuel substitution, 20% was because people just consume less energy. But the absolute number that the U.S. consumes has gone down. The world keeps growing.
The worldwide demand keeps growing?
Absolutely. But OECD demand in general has peaked and is in decline. The growth is coming from non-OECD countries.
With the reduction, drastic reduction in the price of gasoline, is that demand going to start climbing because people are driving more because of the cost being down?
Mr. Chairman, Nikos Alves, for the record, I think you may have some sort of brief uptick, but what I think has happened is the technology has changed so much that the uptick is not going to be so significant. So my point is, let's say you decide, because gasoline is cheaper, to drive, you know, twice as much or 50% more. Because your car in general is more fuel efficient on average, your decision to drive 50% more is going to have a smaller impact on demand than it would have had 5 years ago. So you may have a difference in behavior, but technology sort of will limit how much that behavior translates into actual demand growth.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So you've really helped me understand why I can read a dozen different publications every day, and everyone says something different and related to it's just, it seems like people don't really truly understand. But what is the conventional wisdom out there in terms of at what point the, you know, Saudi will feel that the, and I say Saudi because they seem to be kind of the drivers on it, will feel that they've hit the mark that they're after? Is it you know, the players in Texas, enough of them going bankrupt? I mean, is it, I'm sure they monitor the financial aspects of some of these companies as well. They know the ones that have hedged, the ones that have the debt that are playing into it. At what point do they recognize or they feel that they're comfortable, they've got the market share that they need, and they can continue to adjust the strategy that they're currently on?
Excellent question, Representative Pruitt, through the chair. If I'm Saudi, I'm really looking at two or three things. I'm looking first at this red line here. What is the trajectory of U.S. oil production? So you can see, I mean, you have had periods where it's sort of stabilized. So that's the first thing I'm looking at, is every month I'm trying to figure out, is this thing still growing? Is it stabilizing? Is it going down? And that basically is the output of all the decisions that you said at a micro level of who's hedged, who's bankrupt. That's the first thing I'm looking at. The second thing I'm looking at is investment decisions in new conventional oil. So deep water, you know, Gulf of Mexico, Brazil, unconventional oil in Canada. So if I start seeing that companies are canceling plans or delaying investments, then I know that the price at which we're at, or the expectations of price that we're at, are lower than what companies need to incentivize that tranche of production. So that's the second thing I'm closely looking at. And the third thing I'm looking at is broad spending patterns by companies, how much they cut back, in a way trying to abstract from any particular project, but just trying to figure out, you know, how much is Exxon, BP, Conoco, Shell, Total, Eni, all these companies, how much are they cutting back their capital expenditures for the year? So that gives me a sense of how much people really are buying that these prices are here to stay, and how much they feel like, hey, we can power through this, it's okay. So those are the things that I'm trying to look at from that perspective in terms of how is this future supply of oil or today's supply of oil impacted. There's a ton of other things you look at, which I really don't want to get into here in terms of storage, because that tells you how over or undersupplied the market is. So there's short-term management that goes into it. But broadly speaking, what you're trying to figure out is, have we gotten to the point where new supply is being held back? The clearest indication of that will be U.S. The second indication of that was going to be investment in new mega projects. And the third will be a sort of more general view of how much is the industry spending to go and develop new oil.
Thank you. Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In terms of natural gas pricing, the way I understand natural gas prices is historically, or LNG and other products, it hasn't moved in tandem with worldwide oil prices, but we are moving towards a point where natural gas may someday have spot market prices or be more you know, correlating with the price of oil, and that may or may not be accurate. You can tell me that. The question of the moment for me is, you know, what does this do for, you mentioned long-term contracts at the outset, for the building of a very large pipeline in terms of being able to look beyond this period of uncertainty, knowing it's probably a moment in time, whatever, 3, 4, 5 years, whatever the interval might be. But what do I take from your commentary in terms of, you know, the behavior of big companies and some small companies as well to build a huge product tied around long-term prices of LNG?
The Representative Edgman, through the chair. That's an excellent question. Let me answer it in a few ways. First, I would take away that Alaska is in some ways lucky that your partners are big companies with deep pockets, right? Because we're going through the pre-FEED phase of the AKLNG project. That's costing about $500 million. The next phase of FEED might cost $1.5 to $2 billion. It's good to have partners that can spend that amount of money, right? Because spending $500 million, $1 billion, in a period where prices are falling and you're trying to cut everywhere, having a partner that can spend that money if the project is making progress and is viable is a good thing. So I think that's the first thing to state. The second thing to state is your partners in particular, and in some ways the state of Alaska as well, they know that this is a commodity business, right? When you look at the Alaska LNG project, the question you're asking is, can I make money over a 20, 25-year period? And that is the ultimate question you're trying to answer. And what you're trying to understand is you're trying to put a boundary in the possible outcomes, right? So what this price drop has done is widen that range of outcomes, right? When before you said, oh, I think the price of gas or the price of oil may be, you know, 80 to 120, now you may be thinking, oh, it actually may be 50 to 120. And that obviously impacts the project adversely, right? Because, you know, you're basically saying, well, you know, if you look at this project right now, it has a price tag of $45 to $65 billion, big range. You know, if you're at $65 billion and the price of oil is at 50, this is a really difficult project to do, which makes cost containment a huge priority for the project. It also makes managing and mitigating other risks very important, things like we've talked about in property tax and fiscal systems and all those things, because if you're going to take on a risk here, you want to do that by making sure that you've tied other risks elsewhere. So I would say that in today's environment, the price drop has been too brief to sort of completely reshape expectations. I would say the consensus, for whatever that means, is that, you know, this the price has overshot on the downward side, and it's going to come up again. And so in that sense, I don't think anyone is quite panicking yet about the viability of the project. What it also, I think, tells you is how you sell your gas into the global market, what kind of price exposure and volatility that you as a state would be willing to take. You know, one of the questions that we talked about last year is, you know, how does the state sell its gas? And one of the questions there is, you know, do you want the price of gas to be tied to the price of oil, like it's historically been in Asia, or would you like to have it priced something else, like the Henry Hub price, and therefore be subjected to two different price systems and volatilities rather than having all your income be tied to the price of oil? So those are the kind of questions that will come up later on. So I hope that gives you a sense of how I think about this specific question.
Mr. Chair, I might add to that very briefly, if I could. This in many ways simply restates what Nicholas has said, but I think it's worth saying, which is it's really important when thinking about Alaska LNG to bear in mind this is a project that, if absolutely everything goes according to plan, right, produces its first barrel of LNG for sale to buyers in Asia sometime in the middle of next decade, let's say 2024, 2025. And it earns its return on that capital between 2025, let's say, and 2045. That's the time period that we're talking about for this project, right? And when we worry about the economic fundamentals of the project and whether it's a viable project, we're not concerned with what the oil price is doing today, even what the oil price is doing for the next couple of years. We're worried about if we spend this capital between 2020 and 2025, is that going to be repaid between 2025 and 2045? That's the length of time we're talking about and should give everyone a reason to sit back and say, okay, what the oil price is doing today isn't the driver for this.
Another question? All right. Mr. Mayor, I think you're up next. Mr. Sofos, thank you very much. And again, if we can hold the questions till the end of this presentation so we don't get off track. Go ahead, Nikos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Janik Mayer. So that was the big picture in terms of how we've got to where we are today. in terms of the suddenly very low oil price environment we find ourselves in. The second part of this presentation is intended to focus on specifics that have been commented on a lot recently in terms of what that low price environment is doing to the state's finances, and in particular to the question of how much tax revenue is being generated in this environment and what the state is spending on credits and how those numbers compare to each other. So in particular, and before we get into any detail, for instance, of this chart or what this means, there are two numbers in particular that have been talked about, which is the total production tax revenue that the state gets from the production tax system. That's forecast, according to the Revenue Sources book, in fiscal year 2015 to be about $524 million. And what's forecast to be spent on credits in that same time frame, $625 million. And the point has been made that it should be concerning, and it should be, that credit figure is in fact larger than the production tax figure, and that once one factors all these things in, that through the overall production tax system, the state is effectively spending rather than receiving income through the system. That's the starting point, and the entire purpose of this presentation is to drill into that in more detail and understand what's causing these things, how much of a concern should that be, if it's a significant concern, where are the fundamental problems, what should we do about it? At the outset, one of the important things to say is we're just talking here about the production tax system. When we talk, for instance, about $524 million in revenues, this is one component of the state of Alaska's fiscal system. Obviously, the state also generates a lot of revenue from oil and gas production through royalties in particular, also through corporate income tax, property tax, a whole range of things. So, for instance, I think for FY 2015, the forecast is about $2.5 billion, if I'm not mistaken, in total revenues from the oil and gas fiscal system, about $2 billion of that in unrestricted revenue. Of that, I think about a little over $1 billion comes from royalties, and another $500 million, as we see here, from the production tax, and then the remainder from other components of the system. So that's the first thing to say. With that proviso that what we're focusing in on is just that one piece of the overall system and the production tax. The really important thing to point out is that, you know, if I were a member of the general public, if I were a legislator without a lot of background drilling into these numbers, understanding what they mean, I would hear these two things: $524 million in production tax revenues, $625 million in credits, and think, dear God, what's happening? We seem to be subsidizing people to produce our oil. This is not what this system is designed to do. What do we do about this? The second thing I would say is, well, I know that there's one big thing that's changed, and that was the enactment of SB 21 last year. Is that in some way responsible for this? Because if it is, that's a deep concern. So the core of this presentation, I want to focus on those two questions. Is that what's happening? And if it's what's happening, is that because of SB 21? Is the core of what I want to look into here. The first thing to say on that first question is this what's happening? Are we...
To understand something.
We're going to hold questions till the end so we can get through this. If you want to make notes, and we'll come back.
All right, thanks, Mr. Chair. It's just to understand a term that they're using.
But go ahead and clarify a term. Yeah.
Thank you. There are two kinds of credits. One's not really a credit. I just want to make sure what kind of credits we're talking about here. Are we talking about just credits where companies engage in spending activity and we reimburse them a portion of that spending? Or are you also talking about the, you know, we have a tax rate that changes based on the price of oil? Some people call that a credit, but it has nothing to do with spending. So which?
I think he's going to get into that a little further in the...
I just want to know which credits he's...
Representative Guthrie, the Chair, if you'll give me about one more minute, that is the exact subject of this slide, and I'm about to go through that in some detail.
Okay,
if
great.
I can. So to start with that big question, oh my gosh, I'm told $625 million in credits. What does that mean? Are we subsidizing people to produce through the tax system to produce our oil? The first thing to understand is exactly that distinction, that what we really have here are two quite distinct flows of money. And what this chart tries to do is to show what those look like. The way Department of Revenue, for instance, accounts for these things, which I think is a sensible way to account for them, is to distinguish between two different types of credits, one being credits that go to company claimed by companies that have a tax liability. So those are credits, and we can talk in one more minute about the nature of those credits and whether it's even, whether credits is even the best way to think about them. But credits that are claimed by companies that have a tax liability that reduce the amount of tax that they pay. There is a second category of credits, which are credits claimed by companies that have no tax liability and that under various things in the tax code are allowed to be reimbursed directly to those companies in a cash that is paid out by the state to those companies. And when you think about who has a tax liability and who doesn't, we're talking about very different sorts of companies. Companies with tax liability tend to be, in particular, the big three producers, BP, Exxon, Mobil, ConocoPhillips, that have a lot of production from existing established assets and generate a lot of revenue and a lot of income from those assets. Companies that don't have a liability tend to be smaller producers, companies that either don't have production today but are investing today and making a cash loss, or that are in a circumstance somewhat similar to that. So when we talk about that first category of companies, companies that have a tax liability for whom credits reduce their tax liability, that's the numbers we see here in the first three lines of this chart. And overwhelmingly, the credits we're talking about in terms of credits taken against that tax liability are exactly, this is the point I think, Representative Garrett, through the chair, you were making, credits that are a fundamental part of the tax system. So overwhelmingly, for instance, when we look at these numbers, what we see is if we just applied the 35%, for instance, tax rate that is currently in statute, based on the production figures, we would get somewhere around $1.2 billion in revenue. That integral to the tax system is then a dollar per barrel credit, which takes that down and, again, based on the Department of Revenue numbers, takes that down by $750 million to a total of $523 million in revenue. So the basic idea behind that dollar per barrel credit, it's referred to in the tax code and elsewhere as a credit. In lots of ways, it's better to think of it as a fundamental component of the tax system that in lots of ways does exactly what progressivity under ACES does. It's designed to say, well, there's, in the same way as ACES went from a 25% level tax rate and escalated it at higher prices, the current tax structure starts from the top at a 35% tax rate and reduces it at lower prices. And the way it reduces it is through that dollar per barrel credit. So that's what is being seen in that number of credits used against tax liability. There's a small component from other things, but overwhelmingly that's what's in there. And it is exactly a fundamental part of the tax system that is serving that purpose. Once that's been taken out, as you see, we have $524 million in revenue from the tax system. That isn't the revenue that there's been in previous years because it's a much lower oil price than it's been in previous years, but that is positive revenue coming from, in particular, the big producers bringing in money through the production tax system into the state. And, of course, there's a whole another billion-odd dollars that are coming in through royalties and other things. Separately to that and as a different flow of cash, there is what the state pays out directly from the state's coffers in credits that it purchases from small producers that don't have a tax liability. Now, that's forecast to be $625 million in FY 2015. About half of that comes from Cook Inlet, about half of that comes from the North Slope. This is credits that are going out. Companies that don't have a tax liability but are developing that are cash negative essentially at the moment, in most cases, or only very marginally cash positive, that are entitled to credits under the tax system for a range of reasons. We'll drill down into what those reasons are and how that's made up in a moment. But that's the first thing that I really wanted to clarify is fundamentally these are two different sets of flows. We're getting substantial revenue from the major producing companies. The question is how that flow compares against the entirely separate outflow to companies that don't have a tax liability that, for various reasons, the tax system provides credits to incentivize new development of new resources, both on the North Slope and in Cook Inlet. The second chart here looks at a comparison between SB21 and ACES. Now, you know, the purpose of, as someone who sat at this table for multiple years talking about ACES, SB21, all these things, the purpose of this is not in any way to sort of rehash old battles about fiscal systems and what is better and what's worse or any of that. There is one purpose and one purpose only in doing this comparison, and that is to say, as I said at the outset, if I saw these figures in isolation, my second concern would be to say, is what the legislature did with SB 21 in some way responsible for this? Have we advertently or inadvertently made things worse? Because if that's the case, you know, you might want to do something about that. So it's worth understanding how the tax is calculated, how it might have been calculated under ACES, and understand whether we, actually something that was done that made this worse, how this compares. The bottom line here is to say that actually, and again, this isn't a broad comparison of ACES versus SB 21. This isn't to talk about what happens in higher price environments, which are very different. But in the current scenario of low prices and high investment, not only is it not the case that somehow revenue is reduced as a result of SB 21, actually, specifically in this environment of high investment and low prices, revenue is actually very substantially increased. And broadly speaking, and again, different people can have different views on what the ideal balance of a tax system is, but a big part of the idea behind SB 21 was at the same time as reducing government take at high prices, that the state would be, in certain circumstances, increasing and better protecting the state at low prices to somewhat even up the tax system. The basic way in which SB 21 did that was by taking the 4% gross floor that I think a number of people around the table will have heard of before and be familiar with. It's a minimum tax level that says for big producers with a tax liability, there is a minimum level of tax that must be paid. And so in times of high investment and low prices when there is minimal profit, if we compare what the profit-based tax generates and what we generate if we simply took 4% of the gross value at the point of production for these companies, and if that 4% number is higher, that's the tax rate. That existed under ACES, that existed under SB 21. But SB 21 did something fundamental that's important to understand, which is under ACES, we calculated that 4% minimum. We had a 20% credit for spending on capital projects that companies engaged in, and we applied that after we calculated the 4%. So we started at the 4% as a floor level, but if a company had substantial capital spending, that could take us substantially down. It could take us down to zero. If it took us further down than zero for a large company, the company couldn't go below zero, but they could accrue a liability for future years. So that's the fundamental way ACES worked. SB 21 got rid of the capital credit, and in partially replacing it with this fixed per barrel credit, as this thing that effectively, as I say, provides a progressive mechanism in the overall system, it said, this is going to be progressive, it's going to reduce your tax rate as prices fall, but only down to a certain level, because that dollar per barrel credit can't take you below the 4% floor. So that 4% floor went from being something abstract but not actually very effective or binding to, in most circumstances, being a hard floor. There is one exception to that which we can talk about if people have questions, but in most circumstances being a very hard floor that a company can't go down below, which is exactly what you see happening here and exactly why when we look at the revenue that the current tax system generates versus what, for instance, ACES would have generated in the same circumstances, we're actually generating a lot more revenue, relatively speaking. So we can walk through this line by line if people have specific questions, but the basic bottom line comparison is, and this is doing the high-level tax walkthrough from the Revenue Sources book that looks at the aggregate level, treating all taxpayers as though they were one monolithic block that you get on pages 99 to 100 of the Revenue Sources book. Because you're treating all taxpayers as one monolithic block, it's not as accurate as the detailed taxpayer-by-taxpayer modelling that Department of Revenue does. But with that proviso that, you know, SB 21, the current tax system generates from the North Slope about $600 million in revenue based on this high-level working that the Department of Revenue does. The numbers in grey here are our estimates of what, for instance, applying the ACES methodology to exactly those same numbers would generate about $200 million. And the reason there is because, again, tax credits can take you down below that 4% floor. The capital credits take you down below that, and you get to a substantially smaller number. When we look at FY 2016, where spending, again, by the Department of Revenue forecast numbers remains high, and they forecast even lower prices, that gets down to only $286 million for SB 21, but if we applied the ACES methodology, we'd actually be in the negative. Now, you can't go negative under ICES, that would eventually be a liability carried forward for future years, but that would mean that there was, were we applying the ICES methodology, there would be no tax revenue in FY 2016 under that methodology, and there'd be a liability against future tax years of $240-odd million. So again, it's not to make broad conclusions about one tax system versus the other, it's simply to answer that question of, was there something that SB 21 did that made this situation worse? The first answer is to say, on the revenue side, no, in fact, if anything, SB 21 has made the situation better by better protecting the bottom line in exactly the times that we see of high investment and low oil prices.
You mind any questions on this page?
Happy.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said your last statement was in FY16, the negative ACES revenue, well, it's not really negative because it can't go below zero. Is that correct?
Representative Garrett, that's correct. That would be a liability carried forward for future years.
I understand
years.
That. Yes. And then you have a positive $286 million from SB. Is that your SB from SB 21? But according to the state's most recent forecast, we're getting negative revenue in FY16. So, I mean, I really don't want to fight here, but the most recent forecast we have is we're getting negative revenue from SB 21 in FY16 and FY15, and that we would cap down at zero under ACES. I mean, why is that not down here on this chart?
Representative Gaffer, the chair, it's an excellent question. It is emphatically not the case that there is a forecast of negative revenue in 2015 to 2016. What you're talking about is the comparison we saw on this previous page of revenue being, in this case, $523 million, $308 million. This is a slightly different set of numbers because it's statewide and individual taxpayer versus North Slope. But this is the revenue line. This is the line on spending on other credits to smaller producers. And the way the tax system accounts for this, we have revenues and we have spending. Now, I absolutely agree it should be a source of concern to anyone that spending should be as much or in these cases greater than the revenues. But in both of these cases, we're looking at Department of Revenue Sources handbook working on the tax system itself and the revenues coming. Now, it's completely true that the next line after that is to say, what about other credits that don't go to these taxpayers that are also spent as a spending item through the tax system? But this comparison is an even comparison between these two tax systems, looking just at the revenue line, just at this line here, before we get to this line here.
Through the chair.
Follow-up question, Representative Gary.
Yeah. We're taking in less money than we're paying out. It's negative. And so ACES would bottom out at zero, and you'd carry forward the loss. But under SB 21, we're getting less money. We're paying out more money than we're collecting. I don't understand how you can have this as a positive number when you know that after that positive number, we're paying out more money.
Representative Garrett, through the chair, it's an excellent question. I think it's really important to drill into this and understand it properly, right? Because this number here, this second line, which is what drives the idea of a net negative, which is after spending, not just what we get through the revenue system, we would be doing under either tax system. This comes from credits that have existed for the last many years, right? The question, the comparison here is just on the revenue side of the equation, bearing in mind that, again, as Department of Revenue accounts for this, we have revenue and we have effectively tax spending. Two flows because one comes from taxpayers, is outflows to companies that do not have a tax liability. And those outflows have been baked into the system for quite some time now. That line of outflows would be very similar in both circumstances. This comparison is just looking at the inflows. So, sure, net of credits, and this is just a North Slope analysis, so if you wanted to do that analysis here, you'd have to limit it to credits specifically on the North Slope for companies that don't have a liability. In both those examples, if you want to look at it that way, both would be negative, but the other would be much more strongly negative because you're starting from a negative base and then paying out additional credits.
So if I understand you correctly then, what you're showing on this page is from production. The bottom line on the prior page is nothing to do with production. Those are us paying a company to go out and explore to try to get more production. So it doesn't affect anything as far as production tax. I mean, this is just an expense to the state that we are willing to give that company money to explore and hopefully find something that will add to production later. So there's complete difference in those two that I see. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I would agree with that. I would note that it's people frequently talk about the credits as though they're for exploration. Some of them are for exploration. A bulk of them are for development of new resources that are found but need billions of dollars spent to develop them. But they, in particular, their flows to two very different types of companies, two very different sorts of people, and that are accounted for by the state on the one side as revenues, on the other side as spending. The comparison is between the second line of the chart, which is the production tax revenue, and that's what we're then looking at on the subsequent page. The credits for potential purchase, as you say, is a very different flow to very different companies for that purpose.
Mr. Chair, if I could just, the way I think about this from a little bit of a distance, for the record, Nikos Tsafos, is, you know, you take this 625 number right here, and you basically go below this line. So you have 600, 625, so you're minus 20 or minus 50. In this case, you would be 224 minus 625, so you'd be minus 400. Right? So that's the basic idea, is that that line, the 625, comes is sort of the line right underneath its system, which is common to both. So you're either minus 100 or you're minus 400.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
Can you just remind you, I want to make sure that I'm clear on this. SB 21, that you're really only applies to the North Slope, correct? We're not talking about Cook Inlet, but yet when we talk about our total credits that we have to pay out, the page before this, we're talking about what's included in Cook Inlet, correct, where we have a very credit-heavy, because of the decision several years ago to incentivize the investment in Cook Inlet. This includes that. So we really have to take a different approach to two different basins and how they come together and impact the overall state budget and hence the credits that we see here. Is that correct?
Representative Pearl, through the chair, that is absolutely correct. The next few slides after this address that specifically. But broadly speaking, the split is about 50-50, right? If we look at FY 2015, of that $625 million in credits as a pure outflow cash from the Treasury, about 300 of those are going to Cook Inlet, the remainder to the North Slope, in both cases to small producers bringing online new production. The difference being that on the North Slope, that's an investment in future tax revenue that's going to come from the North Slope. In Cook Inlet, that's, broadly speaking, more of a pure subsidy for Cook Inlet producers because the tax regime there is very different.
Right, yeah. Okay, thank you.
Representative Sadler and then Representative Guttenberg. We do have quite a bit to cover, and I'm sure there's going to be a ton more questions, so let's try to keep them fairly short.
Right. Mr. Chairman, I simply want to say there's a lot of enticing rabbit trails, and I very much would like to see the rest of the presentation.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. You know, the observations on the credits, we give credits because we want to encourage behavior. This is all good. We want to encourage exploration, development, and production. You know, at times a negative number is not a problem if we can see the forecast then going. But we heard through the ACES, the oil tax debates, that it was really difficult to compare one to the other. That when you analyze one set of behavior on one regime versus another regime, they're filing one way because one tax structure and filing another way for another tax structure when it changes. I personally would like the forms to be significantly the same, and then we can compare things and actually see what's working and what isn't working. And then the backlog of audits makes it difficult. But we will and I know your numbers here are off the revenue source book, but we just constantly heard it's really difficult to compare both systems. And could you talk about that briefly?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, to understand, are you talking about comparing the revenue that comes from both systems, comparing the investment and future production that comes from both systems?
Well, let's leave the future productions and the credits off. But I know you're just going off the revenue source book. But there's the functions of those things are not just today but tomorrow as well. So it's difficult to just to say what is the best, from my perspective, how can you say the best thing when we've constantly been told we don't know? With the backlog of audits and all those things, trying to understand what is working one way versus what is working the other way and what is in the state's best interest. So through all the debates I've been involved in all the years, it's you can't compare one to another because they file differently. Now, this is just in production and taxes on per barrel and those things. But how does – so just talk to me about that for a second so that I can get a better understanding and confidence in what I'm looking at.
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, at the broad sort of 30,000-foot level of this analysis, right? And this comes from the numbers in the back of the revenue sources book. You've probably seen before. They're on page 99 to 100, where the Department of Revenue goes through an exercise of effectively explaining at that 30,000-foot level how the tax system works. And they do that by pretending that the tax revenue from the system comes from one monolithic taxpayer rather than, as it does, from a whole variety of different ones. There are differences and slight distortions that come from doing that because there are complexities and nuances that you lose from the details of individual filings, from the details of one person's specific circumstances and their liabilities. But it gives you a very good high-level understanding of how the tax system works that you don't need to get into confidential taxpayer information for, and you can see how the system operates. And this is an attempt to do that simply with those numbers and add in what those numbers would be if you perform the simple calculation that anyone can do at home with a pencil or a spreadsheet for ACES. It's based on a specific set of assumptions, of course, which are the prices and the investment forecasts of the Department of Revenue for those years. If we used much higher prices, if we used much lower investments, you'd see very different numbers, and you would see much more income under ACES and much less under SB 21. The basic idea behind what SB 21 did is to say, in times of high prices and low investment, when there is a lot of profit, rather than trying to take the lion's share of that, as ACES did, the state will try to take a more even share of that. And in return, when the state is financially strained at times of high investment and low prices, when a profit-based tax system does not generate a lot of revenue, we want to make sure that the state is a little better protected. Now, you know, different people with different views on how the tax system should operate, what the importance of incentives for investment are, what the likely response of industry to those incentives is going to be, can have different views on that as an approach to the tax system. But that's the basic difference between ACES and SB 21 is ACES was in many ways a terrific fiscal system for a time of high oil prices and low investment because there was a lot of cash being generated in those times and the state raked in a lot of cash as a result. It was always a tax system as it was structured that if we ever had a time of low oil prices and high investment would lead to years of red ink. And those are the times that we currently have, and the fact that we have something that better protects the state at those prices in isolation, not thinking about other things, yeah, means that when we talk about credits and other things that are being spent, we're starting from a higher floor because we have a tax system that in these specific circumstances generates more revenue.
More questions, but let's just keep going.
Representative Wilson, and that'll be the last question. We'll get back to the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the slide, the previous slide, would it be advantageous for us to go back on legislation and make it to where we're not paying for more of the credits that we buy as a state if we don't generate that amount of money?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, perhaps I can get through the next several
yes.
slides
no,
to
that's
talk.
Perfect.
So this slide was to talk about the revenue side of the equation, what you see on this line here. The next couple of slides then talk about this line, the credits that are being spent to companies that don't have a liability, what those are composed of, and how one might think about what's been done, how that's going to change over the next few years, and what has not yet been done.
Perfect. Thank you.
Go ahead, Janik, and we'll move forward a little. Go ahead.
So if we look simply at that question of credits used against liability, that is, the credits that are an integral part of the tax system that are claimed by taxpayers that pay tax versus those that are paid out to small producers, that's what you see on this chart over time. Again, just Department of Revenue figures. What you see, for instance, the yellow line falls dramatically in 2015 and 2016. And what you're seeing there is exactly what I was just talking about, which is the impact of that hard 4% binding floor, saying it, at low oil prices, high investment, without that hard floor, we'd be paying out a lot in credits. So, for instance, to come back to this working, total tax before credits under the current tax system, $1.3 billion. Taxable barrels times by $8, which is how we would get to the sliding barrel credit, $1.2 billion. Oh, but actually we're only paying $720. Well, the reason for that is that 4% floor. So as prices fall, that 4% floor kicks in and reduces those credits. So it's not really an $8 credit. It's actually much, much less than that because of the 4% floor. And that's what you see happening on this line. This line is coming down because prices are low and that hard 4% floor is saying, okay, hypothetically there's an $8 credit here. In reality, it's much, much less than that because you can't pay less than the 4% gross minimum. And that's why these credits against the tax liability are actually falling for this period. When they rise again in FY 2017, it's because the Department of Revenue forecast is once again for oil prices in the $100 a barrel range. What you see here, of course, in the green line is credits for purchase by the state getting steadily higher, and that is these are fundamentally one way or another capital credits, either capital credits in the past under ACES, ongoing capital credits in Cook Inlet, or net operating loss credits, which fulfill a very similar role because companies make a net operating loss because they're spending capital. It's effectively state support for partly exploration, but particularly development by small producers, either on the North Slope or Cook Inlet. And as ever more investment is being made in those basins by small companies, that number is rising. And that's what you're seeing over the next several years there. So far we were looking just at the revenue side of the equation. We come to look at the credit side of the equation in terms of credits being paid out to those small companies without a tax liability. And quickly look at, again, are there things SB 21 changed? Are we increasing credits on this variety? Do we need to be worried about that? The short answer is there are a number of things SB 21 did to try to limit those credits too. Most of those things haven't taken effect yet. So, for instance, under the previous tax regime, we had the alternative credit for exploration, the frontier basin credit, the small producer credit. Collectively, those things cost the state about $113 million in FY 2014. SB 21 didn't make a deliberate move to stop those, but it made a deliberate move to allow them to sunset. Existing tax code said that they were going to sunset in 2016 unless extended, and SB 21 looked at that and said, you know what, we're going to let the sunset happen. So those things wind down in 2016. For the small producer credit, there's a tail because anyone who reached production in recent years gets that small producer credit for, I believe it's 7 years after that first production, so there's a tail for some of that. But overall, those are credits that are being wound down. They're one component, as I say, $113 million in 2014 of a much bigger pie, but it's important to understand that. The next thing that SB 21 did is it said, in general, we're going to dramatically reduce government support for spending across the board. Under ACES, if you're a taxpayer with a liability because of the way progressivity worked combined with credits, you might have up to 80% support for government spending in certain circumstances. If you were a small producer without a tax liability claiming credits, you would have had, effectively in most circumstances, a 45% level support for government spending because you had a 20% capital credit and a 25% net operating loss credit combined, and the government would effectively provide 45 cents for every dollar that you spent on new development to bring online for production. Effectively, by setting a 35% tax rate and concurrently a 35% net operating loss credit, the idea behind SB 21 was to make those things equal, exactly as they were under ACES, to say the economics for a new small producer are the same as for a big producer, that a big producer can spend money, write that off against their taxes, reduce their tax liability by 35% of what they spent. A small producer without a tax liability can do the same thing. They get it back in cash instead from the Treasury. But by doing that, it actually reduced the total level of support for spending for big producers from a much higher level down to 35%, for small producers from 45% down to 35%. But because, again, there was actually a hardship for lots of small producers who had taken investment decisions based on 45% support for government spending, SB21 said, we understand that that messes with a lot of people's economics and other things, and so we're going to provide a window of cushion by saying that that carried forward annual loss credit, the net operating loss credit, it's going to come down to 35%, but for 2 years until the start of 2016, we will keep it at 45%, which is effectively the same as when you had a 25% plus a 20% capital credit. So it's the same level of support for government spending until the start of 2016. And then once that happens, again, that level of support for capital spending on the North Slope comes down, again, not dramatically, but from 45% to 35%. So these are additional things that have been done already that after 2016 start to reduce some of the outflow in credits being paid out in cash to small producers that don't have a tax liability. That said, there is one big thing SB21 didn't touch that is worth discussing in more detail, although you know, there is a timeline that already exists to review some of this, and that is the situation in Cook Inlet. As I say, of that $625 million in total credits being paid out to small producers without a tax liability, about half of that, $300 million in FY2015, is on Cook Inlet producers. Unlike North Slope producers, Cook Inlet, we don't have the profit-based production tax. What we have is effectively still ELF, in terms of which means a low fixed rate of tax on gas. In most circumstances, no tax on oil. In many cases, concessionary royalty arrangements. But then at the same time, all of the tax credits of ACEs, and in fact then some, because we have some special tax credits, like, for instance, a 40% credit on capital spending on wells, in addition to the 20% capital credit and 25% carried forward loss credit that we had under ACEs. So implicitly, there is a very, very large government subsidy being provided for Cook Inlet producers when you look at total capital spending in Cook Inlet, and you then look at credits. I think it's close to half of the capital spend that is effectively provided by the state. Now, you know, Cook Inlet production is deeply important to a lot of people. It provides gas to South Central Alaska, and there has been a substantial turnaround in what was the decline in Cook Inlet that in lots of ways is probably a result of some of these credits. But at some point, it's worth doing a full cost-benefit analysis and saying, this is a substantial subsidy. Are there ways of achieving the same benefit at lower cost to the tax system, at lower cost to the state? Now, January 2017, the Competitiveness Review Board is scheduled to come back with recommendations on the future of the Cook Inlet tax system, because the special treatment of it expires in 2022. That may be the opportune time to revisit that. But it's important to understand that when we talk about credit outflows of $600+ million in FY2015, half of that is coming from Cook Inlet, and by and large, it's not, unlike the North Slope, an investment in future tax revenue from the tax system. It's a subsidy for those producers because we're concerned about having more Cook Inlet gas. So, to step back to the highest level, come back to our high-level conclusions here. Yes, we've seen a substantial oil price drop, as we're all too painfully aware, just fundamentally a result of, as Nikos has said, excess supply on the one hand because of increased output from the US Lower 48, reduced outages from places like Libya, Syria, etc., and then bearish demand, demand that is still growing worldwide but much lower than anyone expected, and a surplus of oil supply on the market as a result, combined with OPEC saying, given this, we can't actually control the situation. We're going to let it play out and see where prices equilibrate. Given that low oil price environment, the important takeaways on the tax credit system are that big producers are actually still paying large sums. It's just that in this low oil price environment, they're not enough to offset the spending on credits paid to small companies on the North Slope and in Cook Inlet. That on the revenue side, whatever one thinks more broadly of the debate about ACEs versus SB21, SB21 actually placed a more secure floor on state revenues in this current environment of low prices and high investment, and actually did something to eliminate a number of credits. The big thing that has never been addressed is this question of what the Cook Inlet production tax system looks like for the future, what those credits look like, and whether the balance is appropriate. That's going to be a debate, I suspect, for future years, particularly since the Competitiveness Review Board comes back in 2017 with some recommendations on that, and the overall system is set to expire in 2022.
Questions? Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you. The ACES credits, will they be completely purchased by, did you say 2016, or will we continue to pay credits toward the ACES policy in the future?
And back to this. Representative Munoz through the chair, thank you. So on the North Slope, for instance, there are no more capital credits. Capital credits stopped when ACES finished and SB 21 came into place. So those credits have stopped. There is for 2 years an inflated level of the ongoing net operating loss or carried forward annual loss credit to try to compensate small producers for that, and that stops the start of 2016. At the same time, there are some of the carryover credits of things like, and these are smaller amounts, but the small producer tax credit, frontier basin credit, those stop in, again, early 2016. The one exception to that is the small producer tax credit, which entitles, for instance, I think, a producer below 50,000 barrels a day of production to a flat $50 million credit against any tax liability that they have. That can still be claimed from 7 years after that any given small producer started production. So if a small producer starts production in 2016, they won't be able to claim it at all. But if they started production in 2014, they can claim it for, I think off the top of my head, it's 7 years, but that should be checked from that time onwards. So there's a certain lag to when that actually completely tails off.
Follow-up question, Representative Munoz?
Well, and you partially answered it, but did the combined 45% tax credit for the small producers actually lead to new production under ACES?
Representative Munoz through the chair. I would say the small producer tax credit, I mean, again, these are all multiple small components of a complex system, right? The small producer tax credit in many ways was introduced when ACES was introduced as a recognition that there were certain things in ACES that would hit small producers and to try to, compared to ELF, the previous system, and to try to offset that. And that was the fundamental purpose of that. SB 21 also tries to provide benefits to small producers in other ways. I think one has to look at the system overall and what it does to incentivize investment rather than at one minute component, if that makes sense.
It does, but it doesn't really answer the question. Did there, as a result of the credits on the North Slope, was there new oil production for the small producers? Or do we, yeah.
Representative Munoz, through the chair, in that case, I would expand this to look not just at the small producer tax credit, but for instance, in particular, at the bigger credits more directly targeted at new development, which are the capital credit and the net operating loss credit, which together provided a substantial degree of state support for spending by all companies, but including by small producers. I think certainly it had a major impact in bringing a number of projects that were otherwise not within the capital constraints of a small producer and making those viable for those small producers. Because implicitly, there was a silent partner in the process, which was the state. The state was providing a credit up front and then taking cash from the tail in the same way as bringing in, the same way as bringing in a working interest partner might do. With those credits falling from 45% to 35% under SB 21, there's a little bit less of that happening, and there may be cases, for instance, where a small producer that previously found a project within their capital constraint finds it just outside and needs to bring in, for instance, a working interest partner to make what was previously within their ability by themselves viable. And the recognition of that impact is part of the reason why there is this transitional period of keeping that 45% level for a couple of years before dropping it to 35% to allow for time to make that adjustment.
So I guess, did those viable projects then lead to new production? Yes or no? I'm just curious if it's working.
I mean, absolutely, over the last several years, we've seen a number of small producers bring online new projects. in both the North Slope and the Cook Inlet, I mean, you know, on the North Slope, I would need to go back and look precisely at timelines in terms of what was sanctioned when, what had decisions made when. I mean, we've certainly seen a number of small projects come online, and a number of those have been made more viable because of those credits, and will continue to be made more viable both in the Cook Inlet and on the North Slope.
Representative Sadler.
Mr. Mayor, if Alaskans don't like to see lower oil revenue, and as you've explained, wrongly blame the tax credits in SB 21 for that declining revenue, what would the long-term effects be in Alaska's oil production and revenues if those North Slope tax credits were eliminated and everything else was held the same? What if we got righteously indignant and tried to punish the oil industry by removing those credits and pulled them back?
Representative Settle through the chair. To clarify, we're talking specifically about the credits provided to small producers that don't have a tax liability, or also about the ones that are implicit within the tax system in the form of the dollar per barrel?
First, kind of good question.
The first thing to be said is, particularly on the North Slope, those are an investment in both future production and future tax revenues. They exist to make the economics of the tax system for a new producer that doesn't have a liability to give them the same benefit as the large producer that does have a tax liability does. Right? So the large producer that has a tax liability spends $1 billion. That's $1 billion they can write off against their taxes at a 35% tax rate. 35% of that spending is effectively provided by the state through lower taxes. The idea of the 35% net operating loss credit, which is the rate at which it's set after January 2016, is to provide the same benefit to the small producer as to the large producer. And in both cases, that's the basic idea of a profit-based tax system, is the state is taking less money either through less taxes or through a cash outlay, because it's going to take more money in the form of the profit-based production tax in later years. So that's a direct investment in not just in future production, but in future tax revenue. One can look at reducing that, but I would suggest that it's important that that be at the same rate, for instance, as the tax rate. And I think actually that's difficult to change unless one wants to start introducing all sorts of distortions to the way the system works. The situation in Cook Inlet is somewhat different precisely because there isn't a profit-based tax in Cook Inlet, where that is those credits really are a direct subsidy. Now, there may be very, very important reasons to provide that direct subsidy to provide security of gas supply both to Anchorage and to South Central Alaska in general. But it's important to understand there's a distinction there between credit outlays as an investment in future production tax revenue and that being simply a question of timing of when those flows occur, versus direct subsidies that aren't about future revenue, just about specifically providing security of gas supply for South Central Alaska.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Mr. Meyer, let's just clarify a few things, because I'm just speaking for myself. I think a lot of this presentation is incredibly biased in favor of SB 21. First of all, the 4% floor that you're talking about, that doesn't apply to any post-2002 production units, right? For those fields, from 2002 forward, Ugruk, Nikaichuk, which are already online, Point Thompson, which will come online, and all future fields, there is no 4% floor for any of those fields, right?
Representative Guthridge, I would want to go back and check the text as well. The only thing that I can think of that applies to those specifically is the gross value reduction. I don't know if that's what you're referring to, or
for gross value reduction fields, which is also a lower tax, also the 4% floor doesn't apply. I mean,
I appreciate we're getting it. I actually haven't thought that through in some detail, mostly because it's a small portion of the total.
It's a growing portion, but a small portion.
The fundamental distinction I think you're drawing is the non-gross value reduction fields have a sliding $0 to $8 per barrel credit. Because that can get up as high as 8, it particularly needs to be limited on the downside. Those fields have the flat $5 per barrel. How that's applied, and you may very well be right that the 4% minimum does not apply there. It doesn't make a substantial difference to these numbers, but it's a very good point to raise.
Through the chair.
Follow-up, Representative Guerra.
Yeah. I mean, they'll have a bigger ring pack as more time passes. Going back to page 8, I just think there's a false comparison. So all of those credits you have on top, the alternative credit for exploration, the Frontier Basin credit, the small producer credit, those are all set to expire or to sunset in 2016, where the legislature comes back and takes a look and says, hey, do we want to continue these or do we not? That would have been the same case under ACES or SB 21. You're making the assumption that now that SB 21 has passed in 2016, the legislature will come back and erase those credits. But if ACES had remained on the books, somehow the legislature would have come back and made the opposite decision. I think it's unfair to tell us that there would have been a different result by legislators in 2016 in deciding that issue than under ACES and SB 21. I mean, why are you making that assumption?
Representative Guthrie, the chair, I think it's an excellent point. I prefaced my remarks at the time by saying SB 21 didn't directly tackle this. It looked at that and said, we are going to let those sunset. It didn't introduce anything new to make that sunset happen. It simply looked at that and made the decision to say, rather than extend this, we will let that sunset happen. That's not to say that, you know, that's a direct and deliberate action, but it is to say that that issue was looked at and extensively discussed and debated as part of the discussion about SB 21, and a very conscious decision was to say, as part of this new tax system, that will be allowed to sunset.
Through the chair.
Follow-up, Representative Garrett.
In 2016, though, when something sunsets, the legislature looks at it and says, do we want to recreate it or do we not? That would happen under ACES or SB 21, correct?
Representative Guthrie, the chair, I would hope several years before 2016. So in the same way as, for instance, Cook Inlet sunsets in 2022, and the current timetable is to look at Cook Inlet tax credits in 2017, several years ago would have been the time to examine the future of those tax credits, and that time was looking at SB 21.
Through the chair, just last question.
Last one.
Yeah, though that's just not how sunsets work in this legislature. We do it in the year of the sunset. But and then finally, it just seems to me there's a false comparison. There were those legislators who, because of their beliefs, thought SB 21 was a good system. There were those legislators who thought changes and improvements to ACES would be a good system. Mm-hmm. But there was nobody who said, let's leave ACES the same. And you're comparing SB 21 to a system that not a single legislator in the building agreed to. It just seems like you should be comparing it to what others had proposed.
And Representative Guthrie, Chair, as I prefaced at the outset, my purpose in presenting these numbers is not in any way to present some big, you know, we've had the debates of the past several years. I more than most and have no particular desire or passion to revisit those. The aim is not to say, let's reopen the ACES versus 21 debate. The aim is simply to say, given these numbers, if one knew nothing else, one would be very concerned and one would think a number of things, one being, gosh, is SB 21 in some way responsible for this? And I think it's important to go through the numbers and show why it's not and why, in small but meaningful ways, it's actually improved the situation. That's the only distinction I'm seeking to draw, not to say, was this the best tax system we could possibly have? Were there alternatives? How do these compare? Simply to say, have we made things worse? The answer is no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kawasaki and then Representative Wilson.
Next slide just the statement that was just made, whether all things are the same. I mean, one of the big selling points for Senate Bill 21 was that we would have more investment, and under ACES we were going to get less investment. So I think, all things weren't really the same, and I agree with Representative Guerra that nobody agreed that ACES was the right way to move forward. So, I mean, all things being the same, shouldn't Senate Bill 21 have or shouldn't ACES have a lower amount and be considered in the low investment category with low prices rather than where it's at on that slide? Just a commentary. The other thing was mentioned, Representative Munoz asked a question about the expenditures, the credits on the North Slope, and whether those improved oil production. We just had a report from the indirect expenditures as from Ledge Finance, as well as the audits coming out soon. It talks about the capital expenditures and whether they actually went to production. And I guess your comments about the upfront capital actually producing more oil in later years, and that's why we invest, is that we will capture some of this in the later years. Both the report from the independent expenditure report that we put out and from the audit seem to say that that didn't do that. It didn't impact that. And instead, companies used the investment on things like maintenance that they were going to do or maintenance that they needed to do. Can you, in renewal and renovation, can you comment on that?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, very briefly on your first point. Again, the aim is simply to show a direct side-by-side comparison. One could certainly say, hypothetically, are we seeing more investment now as a result of SB 21? And so if this were lower investment, what would that look like under ACES? That, to me, requires making a value judgment that says, yes, undoubtedly, we're seeing higher investment now because of SB 21. And if one wants to make that value judgment, one can do the numbers accordingly. I'm trying to not make that value judgment, so presenting them evenly. On the question of both capital credits and other credits that implicitly provide support for spending, such as the net operating loss credit, look, particularly under the form system, there are a wide range of means of government support for spending. The highest government support for spending under the previous tax system came not just through the tax credits, but through the interaction of tax credits and progressivity, because remember, if you're an existing producer, it's not that you're getting the outflow of credits directly from the Treasury. It's the biggest benefit comes from what you can write off against your taxes. And for a large producer under the previous system, at high oil prices, that was, you know, maybe 80%+, or even hypothetical scenarios into which it was higher. There was a very, very high level of government support for spending. And I think it's absolutely true that when you look at that, combined with the very broad ways in which you can measure, you know, the economics of a new development, what that looks like, whether that passes the hurdle rate of a company in assessing a project, that definitely provided a lot of support for spending on things that didn't need to provide a standalone business case for why this is an economic investment. That, you know, if it comes to all of the, to be honest, hackneyed sort of examples of refurbishing a mess hall or a runway or whatever else, things that can be financed from recurrent cash flow that don't need an investment committee to meet and say, yes, we're willing to sanction the $3 billion to do this major new production project, that there was a lot of ways in which that was encouraged by the tax system. The credits, as they existed under the previous tax system, were, like all these things, an implicit part of a whole. The basic bargain of that system was to say high credits up front, high taxes at the end, particularly for smaller producers for whom capital constraint and financeability is a concern. I think that actually helped a lot. For the bigger companies that don't actually want the capital help up front and really measure a lot of things based on what's the long-term cash flow they get, no, I think that didn't help in terms of improving the economics for those projects, and there are a number of projects that didn't meet the hurdles they needed to meet because of that. So I think it's a mixed bag, if that makes sense.
Mixed bag.
Okay, we've got about 5 minutes left. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go to Cook Inlet. I'm tired of Fairbanks paying for all the taxes up in the North Slope. So I just want to make sure on Cook Inlet, on the subsidies, the taxes, are those paid? I know, editorial. A little bit about that. You know, are we paying that out as a state, or are those subsidies coming out of tax liability from those companies? I just want to make sure I know which one it falls in.
Understood. Representative Wilson, through the chair, it's not completely clear-cut, and again, one needs to sort of delve into numbers that are more granular than the ones the Department of Revenue publishes in the Revenue Sources book to start to understand that, because we can't, from what was published in the RSP, completely understand that. There is a small component of credits used against tax liability that comes from Cook Inlet. I think it's mostly small producer tax credit that's claimed against a very small liability. From my recollection, the bulk of things is credits for potential purchase. And as I say, when we look at that 625 figure, about half, somewhere around the 300 mark, is going out purely as an outlay to Cook Inlet producers.
Okay, and follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
Okay, so is there really any kind of comparison between how we're subsidizing Cook Inlet compared to the North Slope? I mean, because, you know, we seem to get in this battle between the two, and you brought up some good points, which we've tried to bring up, as far as how much cook inlet's getting to be able to, you know, produce gas, and if oil comes out of that, that's great too. That only helps one part of the state and not others. So is there any way to do a direct comparison between how we in the past have subsidized cook inlet compared to the subsidies that we do on the North Slope, and then what we actually gain financially for the state coffers between the two basins?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. I think it's difficult to do an apples-to-apples comparison because the aims of the two systems, as I say, are somewhat different. On the North Slope, the aim of the system is to spend money up front as an investment in future tax revenue. In Cook Inlet, it's to spend money simply as a subsidy to incentivize behavior that one wants to see in terms of seeing more gas for South Central Alaska. Now, I think the more important question is not the comparison between the two, but a really good cost-benefit analysis of what that credit system in Cook Inlet looks like and what is actually enabled directly as a result of it, what things might look like with that not in place, and what other means of creating that benefit might be. You know, either, you know, for instance, it's mooted and I have no solid evidence to suggest this is the case or not, but that there may be a number of small producers for whom the real benefit of having credits in Cook Inlet is that they can use that as collateral to get debt financing that they wouldn't be able to get otherwise. Where that's the case, for instance, are there ways that the state's balance sheet could be used to enable that financing that is more efficient, that uses less of the state's resources to achieve the same end? I think there are a number of questions one could ask about the cost benefit of those things and how the same end might be achieved. And the question then becomes, well, what's the best way to do that? And particularly given in 2017 there is a report due from the Competitiveness Review Board on the future of the Cook Inlet tax system, should that happen through that means or any other?
Mr. Chair, what I would just be, and I don't know whether this is to you or them, but what would be interesting for me, especially since, you know, we used to export gas, and so they, a little extra thing that we're a little hard on, you know, we exported gas, so we gave subsidies to an area, then we took and did those subsidies, then we sold the gas somewhere else out of state instead of helping our Alaska residents first. And I, you know, maybe you can't compare between the two, and maybe this is a competitive board question, whether or not they're really going to look into not just the tax credits, but who benefited from that. Did the state just benefit because they sold the gas, or whoever sold the gas, you know, somewhere else on those, or were those realized in the state? On that. So maybe we can just look at that later a little closer, you know. Appreciate it.
All right. So I think that we are done because it is 11 o'clock. We have people needing to go to meetings, including myself. So Mr. Mayor, Mr. Sofos, thank you very, very much for your presentation. And this afternoon there is a presentation at 1:30 p.m. that will be a summary of the AKLNG project interim Lazard report. And the meeting will start at precisely 1:30 here in room 519, and it is 11:01 a.m. and we are adjourned.
it would do. So it's about a 3.
They're all about the same volume. I would turn those up.
Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record indicate that it is 1:32 p.m. on Tuesday, February 17, 2015. Present are Co-Chair Representative Mark Newman, Vice Chair Representative Sadler. We have Representative Edgeman, Representative Gaddis, Representative Pruitt, Representative Wilson, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Scott Kawasaki, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Thompson. I believe that the other two are going to be joining us shortly. And before I start, if everybody please turn off your cell phones, including mine, because when they go off, they interfere with the recording equipment. Pardon?
No, that's two.
Yeah, don't call me. Excuse me, I'm a violator of my own rules. Okay. Today's schedule, we're going to hear a presentation of the AKLNG project. The Lazard Interim Report, pursuant to SB 138. The Lazard team was engaged to provide assistance in reviewing and analyzing various financial options for the state's interest in the Alaska LNG project. I'm going to introduce first our Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, Randy Hoffbeck, and he will introduce the Lazard team. Go ahead, Randy. Place yourself on the record.
Thank you. Chairman Thompson, members of the committee, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. The chairman has already pretty much taken away what I was going to say about Lazard. It is under SB 138 that they were contracted to do the financial analysis for the pipeline. What they'll present today is the interim report. It's a high overview of financing options. There'll be a follow-up report later in the fall, which will be specific to the project, the AKLNG project, and will dovetail with various project decisions that have been made at that point in time. So with that, I'm going to turn the testimony over to George Bilicic with Lazard, and I actually have to step out for another meeting, so I apologize for that.
Thank you, Randy, very much. Go ahead and place yourself on the record.
So my name is George Bilicic. I'm a vice chairman at Lazard Frere, and with me is our two of my colleagues, Greg Hort, on my team based in New York, and then also Nicholas Bernstein, who is sitting behind us.
Go right ahead.
Okay, so what I was going to do today is go through a set of slides that we prepared that are, in essence, an executive summary or an overview of the larger interim report that we had prepared pursuant to our mandate. I'll go through it, you know, reasonably efficiently, but please stop me for questions or if I'm not being clear. Just a couple points. We couldn't be more excited to be working on this project. Our goal in working on this project is to recommend an optimal financing plan or plans for the state around the LNG project. We've done a fair amount of work to write the interim report, which is what we are here describing today, as I noted. We're looking forward to the work ahead and working with folks in the state and other advisors to try to get to the best outcome and best advice for the state. There is a disclaimer that our legal department asks us to include in these presentations. It essentially says make sure you read the whole report and not just rely on these slides. There's a lot of data and density in the main report that we encourage everyone to read. What I will review today is outlined on this slide with the heading Introduction. It's page one of our presentation. I want to just talk a little bit about our company, Lazard, what we do, and show you who has been working on this assignment. Then I want to describe how we understand what we've been hired to do, what's the point of us being here in Alaska, assisting the state. Then I'd like to give you a high-level overview of the topics we covered in the interim report, and then I want to go through what we're going to be doing to get to the final report that we will deliver to the state in the fall. So Lazard is a firm that's been around for a while. We were founded in the mid-1850s in New Orleans. We subsequently moved to San Francisco. We eventually grew to be a firm with three separate houses, headquartered in New York, London, and Paris. In the late 1990s, there was a step taken to amalgamate the three houses into one firm. We became a public company in the middle part of the prior decade. We are a company with a market capitalization listed on the New York Stock Exchange of about $6.5 billion. We're financially healthy, financially strong. We're a global firm. So this is quite important for this assignment because what we're talking about here is a global business. One must understand global dynamics to give the best advice possible. We are also a client-focused firm. So senior people at our firm are not motivated by transactions as much as we are motivated by having client relationships and serving the interests of the client. We are also, importantly for this project, conflict-free. So we are not in the municipal underwriting business. We don't do derivatives. We would never be lending the state money or anything of that nature. We're just in the advice business and independent in that regard. And then what you'll find at Lazard is very experienced people lead teams. I have my biography is in the back of these materials, as are the biographies of the immediate team here, and that's an important factor. Also, a large part of the heritage of our firm, both currently and historically, has been representing governments. It is something that we care deeply about. When we represent a government, we are zealous advocates of the government and no one else. And that's how we're approaching this assignment. It's quite important, and you can see us in that role across the globe.
We've been joined by Representative Guerra and Representative Munoz, for the record. Continue, please.
This next slide just shows where we are. Again, we're global, 900 investment bankers in every major business capital of the world, and there are people across the globe that we will be working with as part of continuing our advice to the state. The immediate team working on this, the core execution team, is on this next slide, page four. And a subset of the team is here today. This is the right-sized team for a project like this. All of us are looking forward to working with the different advisors supporting the state, the legislature, and folks in the executive branch. So I wanted to next turn to the history of our assignment here, our engagement on behalf of the state, what we understand that we've been hired to do, and a sense of the timetable. So our mandate was initiated by, as was alluded to earlier, by Senate Bill 138 and a Department of Revenue request for proposals. Senate Bill 138 calls, as you know, for the, quote, development of a plan, unquote, for Alaska municipalities, regional corporations, and residents to participate in the ownership of a North Slope natural gas pipeline. Pursuant to this legislation, the Department of Revenue solicited proposals from qualified firms to serve as a, quote, financial consultant on the state's participation in the continued development of a liquefied natural gas project from Alaska's North Slope. The interim report, which was requested by the legislature, provided a detailed description of the project, an overview of the state's finances, and an introduction in an outcome-agnostic way to various financing considerations for the project in advance of the final report. So this is quite important. What we are trying to do in this interim report, and I'll say this multiple times today, is outline all of the options that are available to the state to pursue the project from a financing point of view.
We have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you, sir. Just briefly scoping and looking on page one of the introduction, I wanted to clarify two different missions here. One is to describe methods by which municipalities and residents of the state can participate in ownership of the AKLNG. Second and distinct is state's financing options. Is that the scope of your work?
Yes, correct.
Okay, great.
This is not really a comment on how that's written. They wind up sort of merging together because one can also be a source of financing. The first clause is really a source of potential financing for the project.
Continue.
Thanks.
Thank you. This next slide, page six, is a high-level process timeline. So we've been working on the project for a little over 4 months. We delivered the interim report on schedule, and we are now undertaking the work that lies ahead to get to the final report. We'll be working on, and as I said, we started work on this, we'll be working on the final report as we enter the spring and the summer months, and we will be delivering this on time. This timeline says October 1st. We will be on time. For sure. And again, as we do this, we're trying to deliver advice that provides for the optimal outcome for the state. We will be delivering the advice at a time when a lot of the variables are not determined yet. So what we need to do is create a piece of work that identifies the variables that are at issue here, and that is that allows people using the report in the future to view it in a modular way so variables can be inserted into the analysis and changes can be made. The interim report itself, this section, I'm just going to give you a brief overview of the topics covered in the interim report. I can tell you if you try to read it from start to finish, sitting at your desk at home, it takes about 13 hours if you're the kind of reader I am, which is reasonably fast, but not too fast. So, in this section, I'll give you a brief background of our understanding of the project, including the state's objectives, preliminary financing considerations for the state, and then evaluative criteria. The evaluative criteria are quite important because we'll do a lot of our work around the financing alternatives. And then we're going to filter our advice through evaluative criteria that are important to the state. And so I'll spend a bit of time on that aspect of this section. So if you let's go to this page seven. As we understand it, there are a number of objectives the state would hope to meet through participation in the project. These objectives are both economically and non-economically motivated, or qualitative and quantitative. First is development of the state's natural resources. Second is to realize appropriate investment returns. Third is to support the state budget. Fourth is to replenish the state reserve accounts, to create jobs, to provide natural gas to Alaskans, to provide investment opportunities, and to support municipalities. Our ultimate recommendation to the state will be informed by our understanding of the state's objectives as set forth here and as they are fully developed. Currently, and this is just an overview of the project economic overview, the state is currently contemplating as much as a 25% ownership interest in the project. The project is expected to cost between $45 and $65 billion in 2012 dollars. So as time passes, obviously, the dollar amounts will evolve based on the overall economic conditions. This means that the state's estimated costs, assuming the state is doing this alone for its 25% share, would be around $11.3 to $16.3 billion, which is simply just dividing the total cost by four. The vast majority of the project cost is expected to be incurred during the engineering, procurement, and construction phase, estimated to start in 2019. Project costs may change over time as a result of many factors, including project developments, negotiations, market dynamics, and the passage of time. This is an important risk factor in the project because costs could evolve.
Excuse me. TransCanada's involvement, was that taken into consideration through this process?
We have looked at the TransCanada arrangement, and we have in the big report looked at what the state's economic participation would be if TransCanada were participating. So that's contemplated.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Also, the financial numbers that are in our interim report are based on a Black & Veatch model. Black & Veatch is the engineering firm. They've been helping the state, and we're using their model for purposes of our analysis. It's a perfectly reasonable model. It's just not our model, and I just note that. This next slide is pretty simple, but we wanted to include it. It's out of the report, and it just shows an estimate or attempts to draw a picture of the cumulative projected cash flows to the state over time. And so to state the obvious, because of the nature of the project, the state, as an investor in the project, would need to spend dollars at the beginning to develop and build the project. As the project comes online and becomes operational, it starts to produce cash flows and begins to offset the capital that has been spent at the beginning. This slide draws the crossover point at 2026. Where that point ultimately lies will depend on actual costs, revenues, et cetera. And this crossover point doesn't account for the passage of time and time value of money. This is not atypical. Any big infrastructure project looks like this, but we thought it was important to note in our analysis. The other point that's quite critical, because it overlays on the financing plan that could be implemented, is set forth on page 10. This chart attempts to depict the state's current financial situation, which you're all very familiar with. There are a few points to have in mind when you look at this chart. First, this chart illustrates the apparent need for a new revenue source for the state because of the way the financial position of the state evolves over time. We appreciate that this project could potentially serve this purpose. Second, the chart illustrates a material weakening of the state's financial position in the coming years, which is the period over which the project will need to be financed. So we will be taking into account the potential for that to happen. Last, we note that these projections, which are based on a December look at the preliminary budget for the state, is based on an assumed price of oil that is materially higher than the current spot price of oil. So again, for your background, we will be looking at the overall long-term budget position of the state as part of considering the financing alternatives and assessing the project through the different evaluative criteria we referenced. This is a slide. This next slide is an attempt just to highlight some of the risks in the project. There are a lot of them. There are a lot of opportunities in the project, and then there are some mitigants for the risks. So, for example, there is a risk that the project never makes it out of the development stage and into construction, or that it gets into construction, but there are so many cost overruns or problems that the sponsors are forced to abandon the project. In these scenarios, it is entirely possible that the state could lose all of the investment it has made to date. This will be a very difficult risk to ever eliminate from the project, and the mitigants for that have to do with the partners and the quality of the partners, the planning and the analysis and things of that nature. Another potential risk is that the relevant commodity prices change in a way that negatively impacts project viability, or that there are so many competing projects coming online that there is a global oversupply. So we're watching all of these projects in Australia and Russia and places like this, and some of them are being canceled, some of them are being announced, and we're watching this, and this is why the global perspective on this project is so important. Potential mitigants for the risks include risk transfer provisions on construction contracts, the way you actually ultimately finance your investment, take-or-pay contracts for commodity sales, and then in-depth analysis of competing projects. And we will be taking all of these risks into account in giving our ultimate advice in the final report.
Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very briefly, sir, on the mitigants, take-or-pay contracts, my understanding those are potential liabilities. How would you hedge against the commitment to make a take-or-pay firm transportation commitment?
So
I've never heard that before.
Representative, I think part of what we mean by this is that, and this is pretty typical in today's LNG project development market, it refers to entering into contracts with people that would want the LNG so that you have stability, and they would enter into contracts for the long term, and then you would have stability of cash flows, which could be used to enhance the financeability of the project. Right, so it's the people who take the gas ultimately.
Representative Guerra has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. So one of the mitigants that I don't see there, and I just wonder whether there is anything we can do. When we were making a huge amount of oil revenue, we passed a law that said the companies that get involved in a gas line can deduct certain upstream costs from their oil taxes, so gas line costs from their oil taxes. Made sense to a bunch of us back then. Maybe makes sense now, but now that we're not making $8 or $6 or $4 billion a year in revenue, but almost no negligible revenue, do you have any advice on how to go forward with a law that says the big three, if they remain involved, can deduct that significant portion of their gas line expenses from their oil tax payments? I guess I'm just asking your thoughts, because that's a big – we want the gas line, but it's also a big gulp for us at this point.
Representative, we have not considered that, but what we are going to be focused on is your consideration of risk has to be different than the consideration of risk of the other partners, because they're for-profit entities and you're a government that is serving the public interest. And so we will be looking at ways to, again, repeating the words on the page, mitigate the risk, but also potentially structure your investment differently so that you're maybe not as exposed as the others. We have not thought about doing anything like that through the state's tax policy, but I just, for everyone in the room, we'll look at anything. We're your advisors. We'll look at anything that you want us to look in that's within our area of expertise, and for ideas like this. We also don't have a monopoly on good ideas, and so if there are ideas that come from you or your staff members or things like that, we're happy to consider them. I have not thought about that, and I'm not, So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Continue.
So this next section is outlines some of the key topics discussed in the interim report around financing. And here we will give an overview of the framework with which we think the state should think about its investment in the project. That is, how much money it needs, where it might get the money from, and how it will structure its investment. So this slide is maybe a little bit hard to follow, but it really delivers three key points for you to have in mind. The first is that there are many sources of funds, both internal and external to the state, that the state could potentially access to provide the dollars required to pay for its portion of the project. We view our job as looking at all of those sources. So that's what's on the left-hand side under item one. And it's not intended to be an exclusive list or all-encompassing list. It's illustrative. Second, the state can structure its investment in the project in either the form of debt, equity, or a combination of the two. That's the middle bar that the you're looking at the screen, the orange and I guess blue bar. And we'll be giving you advice on the mix of debt and equity that makes some sense. So debt is cheaper than equity in the world we live in, but you can't put too much debt in because 100% debt on a project like this doesn't make sense, and there will be a period of time where the project doesn't well support a lot of debt. And then third, the third point on the page is that the source of funds and capital structures and how they're chosen will be influenced by how much, how many dollars the state needs to come up with and when and for which component of the project. So there are three big components of the project: the gas transmission treatment plant, the pipeline, and the LNG plant. And that will also affect the advice ultimately.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Edgman.
Thank you. I'd like to just interject a quick question here. Under the heading of source of funds, I'm curious. I see the power cost equalization endowment fund. Just a minor observation.
So someone asked me about that earlier, and I apparently that's not legal or something. But it's just intended to be. We don't have anything in mind. It's just intended to be
a list
on the list. So
I've got a couple other funds to suggest as well.
but we genuinely don't have that in mind, other than to note that there are funds at the state level that could potentially support this. But we genuinely don't have anything in particular in mind there.
My Cook Inlet colleagues across the table here are all sharing the moment, so thank you.
We're just here to help.
Yeah. Continue.
So the next slide, just again, is more on the funding sources. As part of the final report, we will be giving our point of view on these different funding sources, because each of them have different return requirements, different investment appetite for this sort of a project at different stages of the project. We'll comment on availability of capital, whether what we're talking about is marketable and could be financeable, and then precedents for making investments in things like the project. In our interim report, there were some case studies in the back of projects that are similar in some ways, and we'll be commenting on precedents in the area. We'll also be looking at how these funding sources, or the use of these funding sources, impact the state's borrowing capacity and or future borrowing costs as well.
Sure. Representative Sadler has a question.
A brief question. I hope it's not too off point. Looking at the lower left hand of slide 13, third-party equity investors, these all, I don't know, I know John Hancock, I'm not sure if any of these are Asian, specifically Chinese, potential equity investors. Do you envision looking for those kind of overseas potential investors?
So we think there are there's three potential buckets of investors that are four potential buckets of investors that are non-U.S. And probably more than that. But one is the emerging investor class of infrastructure investors. So at a certain point, this project or portions of the project look like infrastructure, like roads, bridges, utilities, tunnels, which is a really hot area for investment right now, and where the investor or the party raising capital can get a very attractive return profile in exchange for offering the investment. So some of those investors are in the form of sovereign wealth funds in other jurisdictions, or in the form of pension funds based in other jurisdictions. So Canadians, Asians, others, insurance companies look like that as well. The second would be people that want the gas might find it interesting to take an equity investment in the project directly or indirectly, including as part of entering into long-term contracts. The third would be just bank lenders who happen to be organized overseas who could be lending money into the capital structure here. And the fourth would be others who are active in the LNG area. So there are a lot of trading firms who might find it interesting to enter into arrangements to take the LNG to resell to utilities or others in other parts of the world.
The reason I
follow up.
And the reason I ask that is because we've heard that that later in the process, it is possible for the state of Alaska to offload some of its risk in exchange for equity as the project advances.
Yes, well, we have that in mind, Representative. This next slide is just looking at the different ways the debt and equity could be structured, with the least expensive cost of capital or cost of financing coming from recourse debt, where the party that has purchased the debt securities would have recourse against the state proper, to traditional common equity, taking an equity stake at the lowest level of subordination in the capital structure, which would tend to have the highest cost. But the factors that go into choosing this are not just about lowest or highest cost. There are other factors that will go into it, including efficiency of capital raising. Do you want to be an obligor directly, you, the state, market capacity, and things of that nature. But we will be looking at all of these as part of our analysis. Page 15. This is quite important. I've covered this point already, but it's, again, stating a it's a chart that shows a reasonably obvious point, but it's quite important, which is that as the project begins and the work, as we sit here today, continues, we're at a point where the different parties have not spent a lot of money relative to what could ultimately be spent here, but the cost of financing is the highest because there is the most risk and the most uncertainty. And as the project were to develop, you would start to see a decline in the cost of financing as the project became more certain, to the point where when the project is completed, at least a large portion of the project would be viewed as a set of reasonably risk-free cash flows, and the financing around that aspect of the project would be extremely efficient. We spent a lot of time thinking about this at our firm because what we see in the global capital markets is that there isn't a lot of capital available that is efficient for greenfield development. So starting an infrastructure project from scratch, there is an overwhelming amount of capital available when you have an operating brownfield infrastructure project. And there is, I hate these words like arbitrage, but there is a value arbitrage between that greenfield pool of capital and the brownfield pool of capital that is able to be captured by the successful party who has constructed an infrastructure project. So this will be something that kind of cuts through our analysis. And again, at the beginning, before the project is, before there are shovels in the ground and things like that, the cost of financing is the highest. There are a series of other considerations that will, this next slide, that we will be considering as part of our interim report. Some of them will be looking at ways to get credit support from the project from certain third parties, looking at whether there are insurance products that would allow certain risks to be mitigated. And then we'll also be looking at ways for investments by the state or others to be syndicated to other investors over time, perhaps capturing some of the value dynamics I just covered on the previous slide.
Representative Guerra has a question.
Thank you. It's probably implicit in my last question, but as you're looking at ways to mitigate our upfront costs and things like that, will you also be looking at the factor in our law that says we allow the big three to deduct a certain portion of their gas line costs from their oil taxes? And then are you the right person to give us sort of a net present value of what we get out of the gas line under the current terms, given those upfront costs that we're paying?
We'll have to tell you based on what we know when we give the final report. what the value proposition of this is, and explicit and implicit in that will be a point of view based on the assumptions about project viability, you know, well in advance of when the project construction is taking place. And we will look at this tax point. I quite frankly, I don't fully understand it, but we will look at it, and we'll just call your office or have to do it through the Department of Revenue's office to make sure we understand the point you're raising.
Sure. If you can get that that information through Department of Revenue to us, and I'll get it distributed to the members.
Sure.
Thank you. Absolutely. I just want to review now some of the, we refer to this as preliminary selected evaluative criteria. We have the word preliminary in there on purpose because these criteria are so important, and they're what we have cited in our interim report, but we'll need to continue to iterate these criteria because it's the way we will be analyzing or filtering through the myriad of financing alternatives that you have here. And again, our goal in identifying an optimal financing plan for the state will be to optimize how the financing plan or plans compares to other plans when taking into account this evaluative criteria. So we'll be looking at the potential impact on debt capacity for the state, opportunity cost. This question came up earlier. So if the state takes $100 and puts it into this, it isn't able to invest that $100 into something else, how are we accounting for that lost opportunity? We'll look at the potential impact of whatever we're recommending on Alaska's credit rating. We'll look at how the risks that the state is assuming or not assuming in any particular financing. We'll look at cost. So this chart that I went through earlier with the higher or lower cost to higher cost, we'll be looking at the potential cost of borrowing or issuing equity. We'll look at whether what's being discussed is so fanciful as not to be executable, or is it really practical? We're going to come up with something that is practical and can be done in the markets at the time we deliver the report. And then we'll look at how the relevant financing plan aligns interests or doesn't align interests and whether that makes sense. So your view of risk could be different than one of your parties that may one of your partners, and that may affect financing structure. We come into our next steps section and to review a little bit about process. There are a number of things that we'll be working on in the coming months. As a firm, we monitor the global LNG market dynamics and project developments. We will be focused on that with a view to the advice we'll be providing to you. An in-depth analysis of potential sources of funds will be part of what we're doing. Same with capital structure alternatives. Further refinement of the preliminary evaluative criteria. The formation and development of potential financing plans for the state. Analysis of those plans, and then a drafting of the final report with advice in the report on optimal financing plan or plans, including as they including how those plans may be affected by changed circumstances. And as we're doing this, just to state again, because we're not lone wolves in this effort, we will be working with representatives of the state and the advisors and taking into account all of their views. And this last slide is just to give you a sense of our process. So we start with potential sources of funds, different capital structures that we'll have in mind, and the state financing need, including as affected by potential partner arrangements. Then we'll develop financing plans. So we have three ovals here. We'll be looking at more than three alternatives in we'll probably be looking at different financing approaches that could be pursued that aren't plans themselves, but that could fold into an overall plan. And then we'll evaluate them through the evaluative criteria, and then we'll give you advice. We take this engagement extremely seriously as a firm, and we're zealous advocates for you, and that's how we're approaching the assignment.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some years back, when we had one of our great oil debates, oil tax debates, which we periodically engage in for sport, there was a an expression that we're always one car bomb away from $100 oil, and we actually went there. And I only say that in the context of the volatility of the world right now. So I hadn't heard you talk about the international risk factors and the volatility of all of these markets. Could you talk about that? If you go from October to today, it's been phenomenal, the swing in prices that reflects our concerns. And you go from today until October, anything can happen. So how do you play that into your analysis?
Representative, so I'll give you a mix of considerations that won't probably be so coherently presented. But so for the project itself, our anticipation is a large portion of the project will be contracted with long-term contracts, where there'll be a stability of cash flows, and your risk is credit risk of the counterparty. And most of the folks who would be long-term contract counterparties here are pretty good credits. They're utilities or they're trading firms or they're organizations like that that have pretty good credit. So that's one stabilizer in all this. I suspect a portion of the project will be uncontracted, where the project will be exposed to the market, the whims of the market. And so the value at any one period of time will be greatly affected by whatever LNG prices are. That's one thought. Second thought is, this has historically been an oil-indexed market, the LNG market. What you've seen from some of the Gulf, one of the Gulf projects in the lower 48, is that they have entered into contracts with a price index that is different than the traditional price index. And we think just there may be a flexibility here to structure your contracts a little bit differently. There's a bit of a whiteboard dynamic here that is an opportunity for the state. The third consideration is, our view. We look at the LNG market, and we look at the power generation market globally. And the power generation market globally is very different because we think coal is going to continue to come under a lot of pressure in every country. You'll still see new coal plants being built in places like India and China, but it's almost impossible to build a new coal plant, for example, in the United States and in Europe and in other parts of the world. So coal is under pressure and will decline. Nuclear continues to grow a little bit, but not as fast as the overall power needs of the world. And it's very expensive, very complicated, and sometimes the risk of nuclear is not fully taken into account. And so we don't think nuclear is necessarily the solution. Renewables are getting better. Wind power is cheaper, solar is cheaper if you're in a place with good solar resource. But in a lot of places it doesn't work, and no one has developed a good 24/7 solution, energy storage. So the answer is gas for a while. And a lot of the parts of the world that are growing and needing power don't have gas, or their nuclear programs are under stress. That's a positive for this and a stabilizer. On the other side, there's technology risk in that observation, because someone at some point is going to figure out a storage solution. And you also don't know where gas is going to be discovered. So we've seen this in the United States, as you know, where it was crystal clear in 2007 that we were going to need to import a ton of LNG. And now the last thing in the world that makes any sense in the lower 48 is importing LNG. So, and then you have just the general front page of the newspaper risk, which is going to continue to be a part of everything that is done in business for a long time, and a risk we can't mitigate. So we're taking all of that into account. That will flow through as a technical matter on the returns that you should demand for investing in these projects, and others will demand. so the cost of capital. But we'll never be able to make this, you know, a safe, perfectly easy investment to contemplate. That's a little long-winded.
That's fine. Yeah.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, help me understand, how will you gauge your success in the Lazard Group? Is it a good outcome for the state, or is it a good process leading to a decision? In other words, is your goal a yes, a well-crafted yes, or is it a well-informed yes or no?
Representative, that's a good question. I would say we need to create work product and a work process where we are evaluating all options, and the client here, the state, can understand the pros and cons of the different options and understand how we got to the particular advice that we provided. We undertook this engagement because we thought this made a lot of sense for the state. We thought it could be successful in different commodity price environments. It looks like a great gap filler, if you will, for the state. It looks like it's something that could set a nice foundation for the state on a going forward basis. We believe this could be successful, appreciating it is really complicated. It is an enormous project subject to a lot of variables. And so we would hope to create a work product that is a foundation to take this to the next level, or to give you the advice that it doesn't make any sense. And to show you a financing plan or a roadmap to a financing plan that could make this successful. Appreciating we're giving the report in 2015, and there's a lot of time to travel before it's ready. And then also just so that people in the state know that we giving good advice, and we've worked hard, and people, you know, believe the advice.
Follow up, Representative Sadler.
And speaking to the duration of your contract, would you guys work up to the FEED decision and then go away? Would you be with us past that? What's the duration of your association with the state of this project?
So as a technical matter, we have a 3-year term of contract. I'm 51 years old, which at Lazard is still very young. We would like to work on this for a long time, but our contract is for 3 years. We like to see things through to completion, but we're here for 3 years. So when we deliver the final report, we're envisioning that questions would be asked, and we might have to change things or supplemental analysis, and we're pretty relaxed about how we work with our clients, including governments. Just because our contract term is over, if we get a call from, you know, John Doe from the state, we can answer the questions.
Last question.
Another follow-up.
Thank you. With all respect, and meaning no slight, and is your contract, it's fully on just a fee for service? There's no contingency. I think your first comments were that you guys are clean, you're not involved, you have no skin in the game, so to speak. But is it a flat contract? Do you guys have any piece of this?
Oh no, it's a work fee. It's just flat fee, and we would. No one asked us for this because their RFP was designed this way, but I think that's the right way to have someone around this, because you don't want us giving you advice to go do this thing and then we get some big fee when the gas starts flowing. Yep. No, it's outcome agnostic. I mean, it's how we always give advice, but that's how the economics are structured.
Thank you, sir. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here today, and I appreciate one of the examples on the economic overview was the slide from Black and Veatch, which we all saw, and I think that members of the committee that voted on Senate Bill 138 saw that as a great way to stem off our revenue decline. But this is predicated on some fiscal terms and that we have not yet discussed, I think, and I'm just curious if that will be in your equation when deciding, because we're trying to figure
slide
out
slide on the budget.
Yeah, it's just it's a typical line that shows cash flow for just about any project.
Well, that slide right there.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I'm sorry, Representative. What
Well, we're trying to figure out the timing, right? The timing is important because at some point in time we won't have any cash. We're trying to make sure that at some point in time we're making cash. And I'm wondering, since we have not discussed the fiscal terms and we're getting this report before October, whether that's a consideration that you're making.
So, Representative, that's why we're going to try to do, I don't know whether we'll be successful in this, but we're going to try to create a report that identifies the sensitivities and that is modular in nature so that you can see what changes if, you know, the revenues are different. If, so, for example, if instead of 68.2% of the project being contracted, 43% of it is contracted, and so you have a lot more exposure to the market. What does that do to the financing? We'll be covering that. But there is a the report is coming. I think you need the report in the time frame that's being discussed. But the report is coming before, you know, information is known, including an updated estimate of construction costs.
Follow up?
No. Thanks.
Questions? Representative Guttenberg again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when this RFP went out and you started looking at it and then you got it, and what I always wonder what advantages a sovereign or a government, the same thing, has in a negotiation like this that the others don't have. When we go into a negotiation or sit down at a table, here we're a 25% partner, what advantages do we have that the others don't have with each other? Or and are we doing ourselves right on what you've seen so far?
So, Representative, I a couple things on your presence. It adds a lot of credibility and conviction to the idea that this could move forward. So the market looks at this and looks at, you know, you can do, in fact, on our report, there's a global map of the different projects that people are contemplating. And yours should be illuminated a little bit more because you're involved. So when people are looking about at what could get done, you know, Alaska's done stuff in the energy industry, and so your presence adds credibility to it. That's number one. Number two, we think that and this is a generic point, not specific to this, because we don't know what discussions have taken place, but some counterparties will like the idea of the Alaska presence for purposes of entering into contracts, because you're a strong credit, you're behind the project. Some will react more positively to your presence as an investor than dealing with pure industrial players. So I think on balance, it's a positive.
So a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. So in the Alaska TAPS situation, we are the owners, but we are not a partner. So we have tariff issues that we approach differently. We have royalties and things like that. Now we're going into an arrangement with as a partner. Do we lose anything as a partner as compared with an owner? In that relationship as a sovereign, is it to our advantage to be in a situation this way? Do we have any advantages that we wouldn't have otherwise?
Representative, there isn't anything that comes, you know, kind of clear in my mind in response to that question, other than that your interests and the way you evaluate risk may be different than the other three partners. And it may cause, in fact, they are, because of the nature of your entity versus the other parties. And that may cause there to be a need to structure your ownership position differently. I mean, this is one of the options we'll look at. It's not a recommendation. And then when you look at the partnership, you could have an alignment of interests that is different, that could be perfectly fine for the partnership, or could create tension in the partnership. But I can't think of anything that, you know, you're losing as part of being in the project, as much as I can see you gaining, because this seems to be a project that could, if structured the right way and if it made the right economic sense, that was good for the state, and your participation in it adds credibility to it.
So,
follow-up question.
So the corporations, our partners, the four partners, throwing TransCanada into there, have different fiscal needs. They need to show short-term profits. They need to show quarterly profits. What the return is on the billions of dollars that they're looking, and it's probably shorter term than we're interested. We have a clear public policy. We might be more interested in having long-term gains, you know, longer terms, lower interest. Oh, you know, how do we mitigate those relationships to a mutual advantage? Is this because you've been involved in this stuff before? Just from what you said, just dealing with governments and advising governments, how does that play in all of this?
Well, this is relevant relative to other governmental situations. Is distinct, but in the private sector, we've worked on situations where we had parties forming a partnership. One party wanted stable cash flows. One party didn't care about the stability of the cash flows and thought they could manage the commodity price risk. And so we structured the party that was worried about the price risk in a long-dated security that was that provided for stable cash flows. They gave away some of the upside, but they kept a stable set of cash flows because they were worried about the risk. The other party assumed a lot of the variability in the cash flows. So that might be one way this could be evaluated or considered.
And are we going to see those options in the final report? Okay.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. You can tell there's a lot of interest, and we can't wait to see the final report. But I'm going to ask you a question. We talked earlier about this is going to address two different directives, one for the local municipal participation, one for the state's financing. So my question is, how much does the municipal individual participation in a bigger infrastructure project affect? Is that a common feature of large infrastructure projects like this? Do Australian or Indonesian LNG prospects envision individuals investing their rupees or something? Does that make it more difficult, less difficult?
So, Representative, what you do see, and some of this is obvious, is just governments doing everything, and it can be done at the municipal level. So certainly in this country, a lot of what we do in infrastructure is done at the municipal level, municipal water systems and things like that. The mix here would be quite unusual. I'm not aware of a situation where individuals invested in an infrastructure project like this, except to the extent the infrastructure project became a public company and individual investors invested in it. So, you know, the airport in Paris, Charles de Gaulle Airport, is a publicly traded company. It's traded on the French Stock Exchange, and there surely are individuals who own a stake in that. And then the mix of oil companies, a pipeline company, a state, municipalities, and individuals would be an unusual mix of investors.
Follow-up, Representative Sadler.
I rather think that the purpose, I envision this individual participation along the lines of invest your PFD in a big, you know, good deal project, which is a bit unusual, I think. So are there other projects that you know of where there is, not through municipal government, not through state ownership, but individual ownership, like some kind of class of stock? Class B stock?
Representative, what we have seen is in Australia in particular, there have been instances where the provincial governments have sold infrastructure, and they sold them to the provincial pension fund, which is where the investors are all individuals in the region. And it was consciously done to provide a long-term source of return, financial return, for a very, you know, very young population in Australia. But again, I'm not aware of any particular situation where you were creating an, we'll look, because there's probably something somewhere where there was an attempt to bring in individual investors. There have been examples where, except to the extent they would have been investing as part of a public offering, there have been examples where labor unions have been brought in as investors. So the original, there's a nuclear power plant in Canada called the Bruce Power Plant, and British Energy bought the plant or leased the plant from the Ontario government in the late 1990s, and the lease, which is really a purchase, had TransCanada as an investor, labor unions, and then Borealis, which is the Canadian pension plan affiliated with OMERS, which is a large pension fund in Toronto. So labor, bringing in labor or workers has been something that we've seen, but not anything quite like this.
And follow up, last one, kind of a comment. I'm going to be fascinated to see our Alaska Permanent Fund was originally debated as should it be a purely investment return, should it be a development bank for in-state projects. I and many other Alaskans will be fascinated to see what your recommendations are for the involvement, yes or no, of the Alaska Permanent Fund in financing this project. Can't wait to see this.
Well, Representative, I hope we don't I hope we don't disappoint, and it's a good report.
Either way, it'll be fascinating.
Representative Pruitt.
Thank you. I appreciate the presentation, and looking forward to the report. If it's half as good as the resumes of the individuals involved, I'm sure it will be something I'll be impressed by. My concern, mostly as we go forward, is it's not the market, it's not the resource, or can we do this? It's the current state of our state's finances, and the fact that back in, and you hit on it in slide 12, which is the balance that we have to have between our debt and our equity. Of course, my concern is, will we have the availability there to fill in that equity portion? I know it's still preliminary, you're still working on the report, but how do you see the current state of our finances playing into that? And at what point do we find ourselves in a scenario where we don't have enough money to put the equity aspect of that in? Are we, and do you guys see us heading in that direction with the current state of our finances?
Representative, I'm going to give you an overly simplistic answer, which is that If the project is viable, you'll be able to find the money, given where you are financially. And you may need to cobble it together with different partners, or but I think it's really quite frankly that simple for a project like this.
So can I follow up?
Follow up, Representative Pruitt.
So basically, from your perspective, there's confidence in the project itself, that despite some of the challenges that we face internally, the project is for lack of a better term, it sells itself.
Yeah. Representative, I'm not being elusive, but I'm going to sound elusive. If I assume the project makes sense, you'll be able to find the money. If the project doesn't make sense, it's borderline, and you're taking into account a lot of factors in pushing the project forward that the capital markets don't take into account, some of the softer factors, it'll be harder to find the money. I think what we'll be focused on in this debt equity split is, your borrowing capacity, what these internal source of funds look like, how the partnership with TransCanada works, other potential partners. But it's sort of oversimplistic, but if the project makes sense, we think you'll be able to find the money.
We've been joined by Representative Tuck in the back of the room. Further questions? Seeing no further questions, Mr. Belichick, thank you very much for your presentation, and Mr. Hort and Mr. Bernstein, thank you very much for being here also. And I'm looking forward to that next report, because this is getting very interesting.
Let's read this one.
So that will end it for today. Tomorrow's presentation will be a summary of the 2015 recidivism report. House Finance will start promptly at 1:30 p.m. right here in room 519. And with that, we are adjourned.